close to something.
Okay. All right. Thanks, everybody. Good morning. I guess this is the day we've all been waiting for, to see how many people we can squeeze into this room and how warm it can get, beginning of the end of May, beginning of June. This is the Public Service Commission hearing on application of MDU to increase rates for natural gas service. The case number is PU-17-295. My name is Pat Ward. I'm an administrative law judge pursuant to temporary appointment designated by the Office of Administrative Hearings at the request of the Public Service Commission to serve as the hearing officer for this hearing. This hearing is on the application of MDU for permission to increase natural gas rates. The record will show it is a little past 8:30 a.m. Central Daylight Time, May 30th, 2018. The hearing is located in the PSC Hearing Room, 12th floor, State Capitol, Bismarck, North Dakota, which is the time, date, and place set by the Notice of Filing and Continued Notice of Hearing issued by the North Dakota Public Service Commission on February 14, 2018. The Commission's Notice of Hearing for this hearing specified the following issues to be considered and determined upon this hearing. Number one, what rates and charges are necessary to provide a just and reasonable rate of return on MDU's property, used and useful, for the service and convenience of the public in North Dakota. Number two, are MDU's proposed rate schedules designed in such a manner that they result in a basis of charge to its customers that is just and reasonable without discrimination? Counsel, please state your appearances for the record.
Thank you, Judge. My name is Paul Sanderson with Evenson, Sanderson & Bismarck. I'm here on behalf of the applicant, Montana Dakota Utilities. At table with me is Nicole Cavisto, President and CEO of Montana Dakota Utilities, and also Garrett Sanger, Executive Vice President of Regulatory Affairs and Gas Supply.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Sanderson. Mr. Armstrong.
Good morning, Commissioners. Mitch Armstrong and John Chu, Special Assistant Attorneys General, on behalf of advocacy staff. With us is Victor Shook.
Thank you. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
Alana Jeffcoat-Sacco, counsel with the commission on behalf of advisory staff, and with me is Jerry Lane.
Now we'll take the interveners. First, Mr. Kaufman.
Good morning. John B. Kaufman appearing on behalf of AARP. Dave Chider is not here today, but he is serving as local counsel. I'm here today with our expert witness, Scott Rubin.
Thank you. And Andy.
Good morning, Commissioners. Major Andrew J. Unsicker on behalf of the federal executive agencies.
Okay, is there anyone else present in the room other than witnesses for MDU, the staff or the interveners that may want to testify at some time in this proceeding that's not here on behalf of one of the parties? Okay, we'll check that out as we get later into the hearing. And if there is somebody, please identify yourself to me, maybe during one of the breaks or at some point, so we don't pass anybody over that wants to take a position in this matter. Council exhibits, and let's talk about exhibits and stipulations and where we're at on that.
If I may, Your Honor, the parties in the case have reached stipulation on a joint exhibit list. I think it was filed, and you should have a copy. But at this time, we would offer MDU Exhibit 1, its application, direct testimony exhibits, the statements, and the depreciation study. We'd offer MDU Exhibit 2, our expert, Dr. Stephen Gaskey's rebuttal testimony, MDU Exhibit 3, Pat Darris's rebuttal testimony, MDU Exhibit 4, Jim Kaiser's rebuttal testimony, MDU Exhibit 5, Travis Jacobson's rebuttal testimony, MDU Exhibit 6, Jordan Hudson-Bueller's rebuttal testimony, MDU Exhibit 7, Stephanie Bosch's rebuttal testimony. And those have been agreed to between the parties.
Okay, so those seven exhibits, there's no objection?
No objection.
Okay, those exhibits will be received, MDU 1 through MDU 7. Mr. Armstrong,
At this time, we would offer PSC exhibits number 20 through 27, which is the direct and rebuttal testimony, surrebuttal testimony of staff's witnesses.
Okay.
No objection.
Okay. All right. Those exhibits will be received as well, PSC 20 through PSC 27. And, Mr. Captain, is it Major Onsicker? I'm sorry.
Major Onsicker, that's
fine. Yeah, Major. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. We would offer FEA Exhibits 29 and FEA Exhibits 30, which is FEA 29 is the direct testimony of Mike Gorman, and FEA 30 is the sir rebuttal testimony of Mike Gorman.
Okay. Any objection?
No objection.
Objection.
Okay. FEA Exhibits 29 and 30 are also received. And Mr. Kaufman.
Yes. I would like to offer into evidence exhibits AARP 41 and AARP 42. I don't know if they got corrected. I think originally there was an oversight. AARP 41 should be the direct testimony of Scott Rubin. It had been listed as rebuttal. Mr. Rubin does not have rebuttal. So AARP 41 would be his direct testimony, and AARP 42 should be his surrebuttal testimony.
Okay.
No objection.
Mr. Armstrong?
No objection.
Okay. There being no objection, and that change being noted in the record, those exhibits will be received, AARP 41, direct testimony of Scott Rubin, and AARP 42, surrebuttal testimony of Scott Rubin. Excuse me. Anything else for the good of the order?
Very quickly, there is no AARP 40 then, correct? I'm looking at the list that was
That's adopted. Correct.
Okay.
This time, no.
So it comes time to certify that record on appeal. There's no number 40.
Well, if something comes up, we could plug something into that.
No, let's keep it in order.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, any opening remarks or opening statements?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to make an opening statement on behalf of the company. Commissioners, again, my name is Paul Sanderson on behalf of Montana Dakota Utilities. We're here today asking you to consider Montana Dakota's application to increase its rates for natural gas service in North Dakota. The company is seeking a revenue increase of approximately $3.5 million with a total increase in rates of about 3.3%. The recent passage of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in December of 2017 had a significant impact and resulted in a reduction of nearly 40% of the original requested rates as filed in July of 2017. The impact will be explained by company witnesses. Under Montana Dakota's proposed rate schedule, residential customers will see an increase of approximately 3.6%, which would amount to approximately $1.82 a month under the proposed rates. The primary reason for this increase is due to Montana Dakota's increased investment in distribution facilities to improve safety and reliability in its system that have occurred since the last rate case. Throughout the course of this proceeding, Montana Dakota will present evidence to establish that due to its increased investment in recent years, the existing natural gas rates today are not sufficient to fully recover costs of providing gas service to the North Dakota customers, and therefore the current rates are unjust and unreasonable as they exist today. At the outset of this case, I'd like to briefly discuss and think it's important to keep in mind the legal standard that a rate case is governed by in North Dakota. The law requires that rates be just and reasonable. And in consideration of a rate case, you must balance the interest of ratepayers in ensuring that there's low-cost rates. But that interest must also be balanced with the interest of the company and the utility that it remains a strong and viable company to provide safe and reliable service to its customers in North Dakota. And we must keep in mind that everyone in this state benefits from having a strong company which is able to meet the service requirements and needs of its customers. Under the law, utility has a constitutional right to such rates as will permit it to earn a fair return on value of property which it employs for the convenience and service of the public, which should be equal to investments in other businesses undertakings of similar risk. Now, I'd like to take this opportunity to briefly describe or outline the issues that have arisen in dispute between Montana Dakota advocacy staff and the interveners AARP and the federal executive agency. The largest amount in dispute in this case between the companies relates to Montana Dakota's employment compensation program, and that's the incentive compensation or at-risk pay that Montana Dakota utilizes. Advocacy staff is requests the commission reduce Montana Dakota's incentive compensation program by an arbitrary amount of 60%. This would be an across-the-board disallowance to every single employee that Montana Dakota has that provides gas operations in this state. Now, Montana Dakota has been utilizing an incentive or at-risk compensation system to compensate its employees for over 20 years. And you'll hear the testimony that this is a critical part of its total rewards philosophy, as will be explained by the company witnesses. Incentive compensation is recognized in the industry as a critical tool in attracting and retaining a highly skilled workforce. And in fact, the evidence will show in this case that at-risk pay is more economical to ratepayers than an equivalent cash compensation that would be necessary to maintain employees at the current rate or a competitive rate. In essence, what advocacy staff is requesting this commission to do is to step into the shoes of the company and its management to determine the best way for the company to compensate its employees. The North Dakota Supreme Court in rate cases has repeatedly held that the commission is not the financial manager of the company and should not substitute its judgment for that of the directors of the company. And in fact, the court has previously recognized that the overall employment compensation package between a utility and its employees is a matter left to the deference and judgment of management through collective bargaining. The evidence will establish that Montana Dakota's incentive compensation for all employees is a reasonable and prudent company expense. The next biggest issue in terms of the amount in dispute is the authorized return on equity. And as with every case, this seems to be the most contentious issue, and which is a result of the calculations being so subjective amongst the experts. The U.S. Supreme Court has set forth the standard for determining the appropriate rate of return for a public utility, and that is, one, it must be commensurate with the returns of utilities with similar risk, two, it must be sufficient to maintain the financial integrity of the company, and three, it must be adequate to allow the company to attract capital on reasonable terms. Montana Dakota's current return set by this commission for its natural gas operations is 9.5%. The company will present evidence through its expert witness, Dr. Stephen Gaske, that the appropriate rate of return should be increased, and Dr. Gaske proposes a rate of 10.0%, similar to what other utility companies, natural gas utility companies, are earning in this country. Obviously, the advocacy staff and the interveners believe it should be less than that, and you'll hear the testimony on that. Another critical issue in this case in dispute involves the current main and service replacement projects. And some of that you've probably seen in the testimonies referred to in Montana Dakota's information application as its System Safety and Integrity Program. But there's one critical distinction that needs to be made here. This case is based on a future, our application filed in 2017 was based on a future test year of the year 2018 as authorized under North Dakota law. In 2018, Montana Dakota is already undertaking numerous projects for replacement of mains and pipeline facilities in a number of towns, including Taylor, Fairview, Gladstone, New Salem, Eldridge, Barlow, and Cleveland. Now, what's critically in dispute with respect to the SSIP is a proposed new recovery mechanism. But what's in the critical distinction is these projects in 2018 in the towns identified are not part of that SSIP recovery mechanism. They're part of what we're requesting for rate base. And why this is important is many of these projects have already begun, and they're all expected to be completed in 2018. And these projects will be used and useful by Montana Dakota utilities at the time these rates go into effect and become applicable in this case. And therefore, under the legal doctrine of imminent use, they are appropriately included in the rate base, and these costs should be included in the rate base. And that takes us to the bigger issue in dispute is the SSIP recovery mechanism. And advocacy, what Montana Dakota Utilities is proposing is the adoption of a new SSIP recovery mechanism. And that's what advocacy staff and AARP object to in their testimony. It's important in this consideration to realize approximately 25% of Montana Dakota's entire natural gas system is over 50 years old, and some well older than that. While Montana Dakota has continuously been in the process of replacing pipe as necessary, the company now recognizes the need for continuing safety improvements to an aging gas infrastructure. Montana Dakota, with this proposal in this case, is being proactive about replacing its pipeline infrastructure by implementing its SSIP. It's a risk-based approach focusing on prioritizing safety, asset replacement, and mitigating rate impact on customers. The company's SSIP will help expedite the replacement of Montana Dakota's aging pipeline system by promoting a timely rate recovery mechanism for the investments it makes in its infrastructure. The proposed SSIP safety recovery mechanism would permit Montana Dakota to recover specific project costs under that mechanism without the need to file an expensive and full-blown rate case. Montana Dakota's witnesses will take the time to explain how these projects are selected and will be included in the SSIP program, and also how the proposed funding mechanism, if adopted, will be implemented. However, it's very important to note in this entire discussion that no costs recovered under the SSIP program would be permitted without the approval of the commission in each and every instance. And this would be a benefit to North Dakota customers. It would be a more gradual rate increase instead of the one-time sticker shock that will come for paying for these increased investments. And the other key benefit, it would avoid these costly rate cases on behalf of the company and staff and the commission. Ensuring pipeline safety is about more than just replacement and cost recovery. It's about working together with the commission to establish a long-range strategic plan to ensure a safe and reliable gas and pipeline system. You're going to see this is exactly why in July of 2013, the National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners adopted a resolution entitled Resolution Encouraging Natural Gas Line Investment and the Expedited Replacement of High-Risk Distribution Mains and Service Lines, which urged state commissions to adopt alternative rate recovery mechanisms to accelerate the replacement of the aging natural gas pipeline system in this country. And this is not a unique or novel concept that Montana Dakota is proposing in this case. Already over 36 states in this country have adopted a rate recovery mechanism to address the issues with the aging infrastructure. So Montana Dakota in this case is urging the commission in this case to take a proactive approach to this critical public safety issue and adopt the company's proposed SSIP recovery mechanism. Now there's a few other miscellaneous items that I want to briefly touch on that are in dispute between the company and advocacy staff and the interveners. One is inflation. This case was filed in 2017 based on a future test year. Montana Dakota is seeking roughly 2% inflation on some minor expenses, and they're basing that on the average of 6 fully recognized publications on inflation. Advocacy staff is proposing a complete disallowance of any inflation on operating expenses. There's also an issue with work and vehicle equipment that advocacy staff takes an issue with, and Travis Jacobson on behalf of the company will talk about these issues and explain why staff has miscalculated the calculations. Then there's also an issue that advocacy staff takes with the use of the limited use of the company airplane for Montana Dakota's North Dakota gas customer or gas operations, the employee housing decisions that it made during the Bakken oil boom, and certain advertising and expense dues. Again, Montana Dakota will advocate and argue that these are, again, examples of the staff improperly asking you as the commissioners to step into the shoes of the management of the company to make business decisions with respect to these issues. And it's not appropriate in these cases. The parties are in agreement with the allocation of how the increase in rates should occur between the classes. However, there are some minor disagreements with how the increase should be applied to residential customers. In the last rate case in 2015, this commission adopted a straight fixed variable rate design in which residential customers will simply pay a flat fee service charge. The advocacy staff is requesting that the increases be now added as a volumetric charge. The Montana Dakota takes the position that there's no justification to revert back to the previous rate design that existed and proposes that these increases continue to be used the straight fixed variable rate design that's a single service charge. In addition, there's a dispute regarding the allocation of cost distribution of mains pursuant to a minimum systems approach that the company is offering, where 25% of the allocated costs would be assigned or allocated to customers and 75% being allocated to demand. While the federal executive agency agrees with this position, AARP opposes this proposal. But those are the issues with rate design. With respect to the witnesses, I just would like to outline the witnesses we expect to call here. First, we'll call Nicole Cavisto, the president and CEO of Montana Dakota, to give an overview of the company and its application in this case. We intend to call Pat Darris, the Vice President of Gas Operations, to talk about the SSIP program and how those projects are selected. We'll call Travis Jacobson, our Manager of Regulatory Affairs, to discuss the rate base and revenue requirement issues that are in dispute. We'll call Matt Shoemake. He's a regulatory analyst, and he's going to discuss the customer and projected volumes used in our application. Tammy Nygaard is our controller, and she will talk about the company's capital structure. I've already referenced Dr. Stephen Gaskey, who will provide testimony regarding the cost of equity and the required rate of return. We'll call Jim Kaiser, the Director of Human Resources for Montana Dakota, who will discuss the employee compensation program and the importance of the incentive and at-risk pay. Jordan Hudson-Bueller is a senior regulatory analyst who will be called to talk about the class cost of service study. And Stephanie Bosch, the regulatory affairs manager, will discuss the tariffs that are being proposed to implement this. We also have the filed testimony of Earl Robinson, an expert. He did Montana Dakota's depreciation study. He'll be available by phone. I'll represent that none of the parties had issues with the depreciation study, so we do not intend to call him, but if the commissioners have any issues they want, we will make him available to testify by phone. In closing, Montana Dakota would like to thank you as commissioners for the opportunity to present its case supporting its increase in natural gas rates. The company looks forward to the open discussion of these important issues over the course of this hearing. Thank you.
Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you, Judge. Commissioners, I'll be brief because, as you just heard, we have numerous witnesses to go through. In the room with staff also are its witnesses, Carl Pavlovic, Marlon Griffin, and Dante McGrace, who you'll hear testimony from later, as well as Victor Shook. Overall, I will say that we do not agree with the characterization of staff's position that was stated in the company's opening statement. We believe staff's recommendations completely comply with the law and result in a fair and reasonable rate. At the outset, I will note that MDU has the burden to show that its proposed rates are just and reasonable. Staff asserts MDU's requested increase is, quite simply, too much. We believe the evidence will show that the requested increase includes imprudent or unsupported expenditures and is seeking to recover these from ratepayers at an inflated return. As you'll see from the pre-filed testimony, and as you just heard from Mr. Sanderson, there are many areas in dispute. We do not intend to address every single area through the course of this evidentiary hearing. That's not because we agree with it or are waiving any argument, but there's pre-filed testimony that we believe fully evaluates those issues, and you'll have a chance to review that after the hearing, if you haven't reviewed it already. But we do rely on that pre-filed testimony and ask you to look at it and consider it carefully. In addition to the straight dollars in the requested return, one of the major disagreements is the requested implementation of the System Safety and Integrity Program. We'll call that SSIP. Sometimes we call it SIP. That's what we're talking about when we're using those words. Staff strongly disagrees with this program. MDU has operated an overall safe and reliable system basically forever. Now it wants to change the system for certain items and essentially create a rider that will be subject to less scrutiny but will pass significant costs along to customers. Staff believes that type of implementation is not best decided in this rate case. We believe those projects should be reviewed in a rate case type proceeding with experts, interveners, briefing, parties, evidentiary hearings, and just as we're going to do throughout this hearing, to provide the scrutiny that those major expenditures deserve. At the end of this case, we hope you will see that staff's recommendation provides a sufficient return for the company that is just and reasonable, does not pass unsupported expenses on to customers, and recognizes the importance of the scrutiny of major projects through a rate case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Armstrong. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, any opening comments?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Kaufman, opening statement.
Thank you. May it please the Commission, Chairman Christman. Just briefly, AARP is here on behalf of its 88,000 members in North Dakota. Many of these members are MDU gas customers, and AARP intervenes in rate cases because its members have told it that this is a very high priority for their financial security. Many older customers live on fixed incomes with little hope that their income might increase as much as as their energy burden demands. So we do appreciate your scrutiny of this rate case, and we appreciate that you're all here today, hope that you take with you the knowledge that every dollar matters to many of the people who would be impacted on the residential class, which we are here concerned with exclusively. We also would like to thank you for the local public hearings that you held in this case. Many of our members appreciate that opportunity to speak directly to you, and it's one of the many reasons that AARP prefers these full rate cases and the thorough scrutiny that they receive as opposed to the surcharge mechanisms that utilities often propose. Tomorrow, we'll have the opportunity to put our witness on the stand, Scott Rubin, who is a nationally recognized rate design expert. With considerable experience. We have essentially four issues that we wish to talk about, and only two of which I would like to preview for you now. And these are very big issues for us. I'll just mention the SSIP mechanism that was discussed by Mr. Sanderson. We oppose this idea along with the staff and do not believe that it is about providing safe and adequate service. We believe that the current system does a very good job of doing that. We are not aware of any evidence that shows that states that apply an additional surcharge to the bill have any safer systems with regard to any measurable metric. We know that the company is arguing that that this will save ratepayers money by reducing the number of rate cases. Now, the rate case expense for this thorough review is much less in our minds than the amount of cost savings that have been found as a result of this rate case. And one of our many concerns with the with a surcharge type paradigm is that you lose the opportunity to recognize offsetting factors. Now, main replacements are clearly the major expense that is increasing for the utility, but there are other factors and expenses that are going the other direction. There's also revenue increase that we'll be recognizing in this case that you wouldn't otherwise be able to recognize. It would be a mechanism that would allow for rate increases without recognizing all the other moving parts in the system. And some of those moving parts you cannot anticipate. In this case, originally it was not known that we would have such a dramatic reduction in the corporate tax rate. So the TCJA is being recognized to the benefit of customers in this case. Had we not had a full rate case and rates increasing based on an SSIP mechanism, ratepayers, it would be questionable whether or not ratepayers would see that benefit. So from our perspective, the all relevant factors, full review is the way we like to see rates change. The other issue that is of great importance to us is rate design within the residential class. There is no dispute in the record as to allocating the revenues. All the parties have recommended that to the degree that there's a need for an increase, that it be applied to the residential and firm general rate. What we're talking about with the fixed charge for distribution rates is within the residential class. We believe the evidence will show that at least or no more than 75% of the costs are customer related, and that is, you know, the same for every customer or fixed. However, the utility is wanting to continue a straight fixed variable rate design that would apply 100% of the cost to a fixed fee for the delivery of gas, regardless of how much that customer uses. We believe that a just and reasonable rate that is actually based on cost and on the cost study would have some component for usage, some volumetric component. We believe that putting 100% in a flat fixed fee is extreme. It's out of the mainstream, and we would recommend that the commission apply whatever increase comes out of this case to a volumetric part, because as I said, there is no dispute. We believe that it's less than 70%, but 75%, but there is no evidence in the case that shows that any more than 75% of the cost to delivering gas to the residential customer are customer related. So based on those issues, we'll address all of our issues tomorrow through our witness. That's all I have, and appreciate being here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kaufman. Major Unsicker.
Thank you, sir. Good morning, commissioners. The Federal Executive Agencies represents all federal entities within MDU's territory, most notably in this case is Minot Air Force Base. MDU filed a class cost of service study in this case, and the company's proposed class cost of service study reasonably and accurately measures its cost of providing local gas transmission and distribution services to its various retail rate classes. In fact, the company's cost of service study results show that the Air Force current rate, which is rate 64, is overcollecting its cost of service by $17,685 at the company's proposed rate of return. The company's cost of service study also shows that the Air Force base rate 65 that it pays for the operation and maintenance of the Air Force's base distribution system near Minot, North Dakota, is overcollecting its cost of service by $9,647 at the company's proposed rate of return. Therefore, the Air Force's current rates result in a total overcollection of $27,332 per year for the Air Force. Hence, the company's cost structure suggests that the Air Force base should receive a reduced rate. It is important to note that MDU proposes to collect its requested increase from only two rate classes, the residential and firm general service class. Therefore, a system average increase in this case would be inappropriate, as it would result in an annual bill increase of $87,000 to Minot Air Force Base. Now, you'll hear from our expert witness, Mr. Gorman, I believe on Friday, to talk about return on equity. The company's claimed revenue deficiency is based on a requested return on equity of 10% in this case. We believe that this 10% return on equity is substantially in excess of current capital market costs. A more reasonable return on equity for MDU would be no more than 5%, 9.5%, I apologize. And possibly lower. Altering the cost of service to reflect a 9.5% return on equity would lower the company's claimed revenue deficiency by approximately $555,000. Finally, the money saved by Minot Air Force Base will benefit the local community. In fiscal year 2017, the base's economic impact came to $580 million. Many of these dollars are spent in the Minot community to keep the base running. The amount paid to local schools, including for many airmen for off-base education, came to $9.2 million. Construction expenditures were $46 million. These factors help to sustain the economy and jobs in the Minot area. So in closing, the federal executive agencies would ask that it be required to pay fair and reasonable rates in this case. Thank you, Commissioners.
Thank you, Council. I guess at this point we'll ask Commissioners if they have any opening remarks before we get into the witnesses in the hearing. Mr. Crocius.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here. I'll keep this brief because we have a lot of ground to cover and it's going to be a busy 3 days. But rate cases, they're really about creating a balance. It's about protecting consumer interests. It's about balancing that with company needs, also while looking at the safety and reliability of the system as well, and what is the appropriate mechanism for collecting those dollars that it obviously takes capital to do those types of projects. And really, as we go through this, quite a number of my questions will be centered around the mechanism for collecting, if it's appropriate, if it's not appropriate. But I also recognize from spending a few years in the private sector that attracting capital is also very important. We want healthy companies operating in North Dakota, but we also want households that are doing well at the same time, and we want businesses to also be able to take advantage of low-cost energy, and we're fortunate in North Dakota to have some of the lowest utility rates in the country. So we're very fortunate in that respect. And I think some excellent points have been made without question, and everyone has a different interest, slightly different angle, oftentimes depending on who you represent. If you're representing low-income households, every little bit matters. And that was one thing that was really struck me when we had our public hearings. The people that showed up and talked about the $2.98 that it originally started at, it shouldn't be surprising to any of us that people will show up because Social Security checks aren't growing and everything else is going up around them. And this is one of the few opportunities they have to come in and to express their concern with the rising cost of just being able to try and live a normal life. So very understandable, and the public input on during the course of this rate case was very beneficial to hear. So really at the end of the day, again, this is about balancing customer interests with company needs and also doing what's right for North Dakota as a whole. So look forward to the witnesses that will be coming across the stand, and I'll save my questions for that point in time. Thanks.
Thank you. Commissioner Fedorchak, hope you go next.
Good morning, everybody. It's great to be here. First, I want to say thanks to the parties in particular who are taking time to intervene in this. It's really helpful for us to have third parties involved and bring out additional issues that we need to be looking at and thinking about. And it's a big investment of your time and resources to take part in these types of proceedings. So I wanted to make sure that you understand how much we appreciate that and value your input. So thank you very much for being here. Secondly, I counted 5 members of the media, and I'm not sure if you guys understand the rules for how these rate cases work, but once you're in the room, you don't get to leave, so you've got 3 days to cover. Sorry, James. It's the rules. No, thank you to you all for being here, too, and hopefully you are getting a good summary of everybody's issues here right at the beginning. It's good to be here at the front end, and maybe you want to come for the closing and see where everything ends up on Friday afternoon, and that might be the simplest way for you to get what you need from these proceedings, because there will be an awful lot of detail covered. Finally, I think it's hard for the public to understand what the Public Service Commission does. I get those kinds of questions a lot when I'm out and about, and especially because we run for office, and so people really think, what in the world am I even voting for here? And so it's hard to explain a rate case. I mean, you can talk about the rates, but really everything gets involved in it. It's so technical, most people just don't have time to care. So I always break it down like this. If you care about cold beer and hot showers, then you should care about the Public Service Commission. And most people then say, oh, yes, I do care about those things. And when you're talking to kids, I say, if you care about, we try to make sure that when you plug your phone into the wall, there's actually power to charge it. And their eyes get huge and say, thank you for that. And so, it really does. It gets that simple. I mean, this is what all of these volumes of papers is about, is safe, reliable, affordable utility service, in this case gas, to citizens in North Dakota. And so I will listen intently to all of your arguments. I do care a lot about the SSIP program and how that mechanism would work. I care a lot about the safety. I want to really dig into those issues and understand both the safety pieces, what's driving it, and the recovery mechanism. And so I appreciate all the time that the witnesses have already spent on that and all the testimony and those on those regards. Not that there other issues aren't important, but for me, in terms of customer impact and long-term needs of the system, that's the biggest issue here. So thanks for your time, and look forward to spending the next 3 days with y'all.
Thank you. Chairman Christman.
Well, not probably as enticing of a subject as appropriate recovery or rate base, but for people who are new to the commission and have never been here and are going to be sitting through full days of hearings, just an announcement. There's a women's restroom right out in the by the elevators where you came up. Hopefully everybody was able to get an elevator with only half of them operational. So that's for the ladies. For the gentlemen in the northeast corner out there, there's a doorway, takes you to a stairway. You can go either up or down one floor, and there's men's restrooms by the elevators on the uneven-numbered floors. I don't know that we ever have had a rate case or anything else with this much detail and opening comments. You guys covered a lot of ground already, and so I think what is clear from that is that we're going to have a very interesting 3 days or however long it ends up taking to get through all the material. I guess the one thing that I think has not been emphasized enough as we kick this off, because I want to give kudos to my fellow commissioners here and our staff for being on top of things months ago already. Mr. Sanderson talked about the need for a fair and reasonable return for the company. I think anyone who's run for office understands the need for the lowest possible rates for the consumers as well as the reliable service. But, and I don't want to jump ahead in the case, but in reading the rebuttal testimony and the surrebuttal testimony as well as listening to the opening comments, it seems like one thing that is pretty much agreed on by everybody is the Tax Cut and Job Act benefits that are being developed into this, whatever the new rates end up being. And they are substantial. And North Dakota, once again, gets left out of a lot of conversations, but in December already, this commission took action to recognize those savings. I think took the appropriate method, since we had several rate cases coming, to, instead of just kind of guessing and setting something, account for the money, but we will get it back appropriately as we proceed with these rate cases. And although I've seen things coming from all types of publications, including one from the U.S. House of Representatives that showed North Dakota as being one of a handful of states and not doing anything, I will point out North Dakota was one of the very first states that took an action to make sure to appropriately get the tax savings money back to the consumers, and I'm proud of this agency for doing that.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, and Major, on Memorial Day weekend, thank you for your service, but would you spell your name, please, for me?
Yes, sir. It's UNS as in Sierra, ICKER.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thanks. The good news is, based on our scheduling, we're slightly ahead of schedule at the moment after opening statements and opening comments. We're going to try to keep this on schedule. We've got 16 at least expert witnesses that I can think of to get through in the next 3 days, and a lot of complicated material, but some really good contested issues. I think it's going to be a great hearing. So let's get on with it. Mr. Sanderson, you can call your first witness.
Thank you, Your Honor. Montana Dakota Utility would call Nicole Cavisto.
Ms. Cavisto, I know you've been through this procedure before, and for everyone in the room, I'm going to give a perjury admonition that I'm required by law to give. If you listen carefully, I won't have to give it to every witness over and over. I'm required by law to advise you of the law regarding perjury in this state. Perjury is a false statement under oath of a material fact made by a person who knows or does not believe the statement to be true at the time it is made. Perjury is a Class C felony. A Class C felony is subject to a maximum penalty of 5 years in prison, a fine of $10,000, or in some cases, both may be imposed. Having been advised of the penalty for perjury, please raise your right hand so I can administer the oath. Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Thank you. Mr. Sanderson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Ms. Cavisto. Could you please state your full name and business address for the record?
Yes, Nicole Cavisto, 400 North 4th Street.
And whom are you employed by?
Montana Dakota Utilities.
And what is your position with Montana Dakota?
President and CEO.
And could you briefly describe your responsibilities in that role?
Sure. I'm responsible for the development, coordination, and implementation of strategies for our four operating utilities that operate across 8 states.
And could you just briefly describe your educational background and work experience for the commission?
Sure. I have a bachelor's degree with a major in accounting from Minnesota State University, Moorhead. I have worked for the company essentially my entire career, which is about 23 years. Started out at our corporate office at MDU Resources, worked there for a majority of my career, and left there as the chief accounting officer and controller, and then came down to the utility and worked as vice president of operations for a year before assuming my current role about 3.5 years ago.
And have you testified in other proceedings before state regulatory bodies?
I have. I've testified in all 8 of our states.
And are you familiar with Montana Dakota's application for a rate increase in this case?
I am.
And could you describe your involvement in this application?
Yes, I authorized the filing and had the ultimate decision to file the rate case.
Now, with respect to your testimony here this morning, Ms. Cavisto, have you prepared PowerPoint slides to kind of summarize your testimony?
Yes, I have.
And as we go along, feel free to utilize those slides. But first off, can you just provide a brief overview of Montana Dakota's application for a natural gas rate increase in this case?
Sure. I'll turn to my first slide to just give a brief overview on the application. We did file for an increase. That application was filed on July 21st of 2017. The increase at that time we were requesting was $5.9 million, or 5.4% overall, which would be a change in our distribution prices. As was mentioned in opening statements, we certainly were beneficial to have the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act enacted in December 21st of 2017. That alone decreased our request by $2.3 million. So the current request in front of the commission is $3.6 million, or an overall increase of 3.3%.
Ms. Cavisto, could you just give a general summary of Montana Dakota's gas operations in North Dakota?
Yeah, I'd point your attention to the map in terms of the slide deck here behind us. Really, when you look at our service territory in North Dakota on an overall basis, on the gas side of our business, we serve around 109,000 customers. 94,000 of those are residential customers. We're in about 74 communities and do this with about 562 dedicated employees.
And Ms. Cavisto, could you just explain why Montana Dakota has filed this rate application for gas increases?
Sure. Again, this slide demonstrates the primary reason for the increase, and it really is investment. When you look at our projected 2018 investment at the end of the year, we're anticipating that to be $275 million in total, which represents an increase of around $41 million or 18% compared to the last commission review. What that investment relates to is really the replacement of our aging infrastructure. It was mentioned in opening comments, and then also enhanced reliability. And, of course, when you add investment to your system, it does increase your operating expenses for things such as depreciation, property taxes, and with labor being a large portion of our operating expenses as well, we did see some wage increases as well there.
And can you just summarize some of the major investments the company has made since its last rate case?
Sure. On this slide, we show a couple pictures of some of the major investments. Included in the case are some new town water stations, distribution mains to support our system. We also have included in the case some looping distribution systems around certain communities, as well as an interconnection with Northern Border and pipeline in Mandan.
And Ms. Cavista, we've already heard a number of the parties and the commissioners talk about Montana Dakota's proposed System Safety and Integrity Program, the SSIP. Could you just briefly explain what that is and what prompted the company to include it in this rate case?
Sure. As we continue to look at our system, as has been mentioned again in opening remarks, when we've got 2,575 miles of distribution pipe and about 110,000 service lines throughout our territory in North Dakota. As again was mentioned, 25% of that was installed before 1970. And we really feel like now is the time to take a look at a more proactive approach for replacing that aging infrastructure to enhance the safety of our system. Moving to the next slide, really what we're doing here is responding to the United States Secretary of Transportation's call to action that was placed in 2011. As mentioned in opening remarks, 36 other states have a similar mechanism in place, and we have referenced that in an AGA study that has been conducted. On top of that, NARUC has put resolutions together both in 2013 and in 2017, encouraging commissions to work with companies in terms of adoption of safety-type mechanisms and trackers. What we've based this on is our Distribution Integrity Management Plan and program, and we're really focusing our system safety program on early vintage plastic pipe and early vintage steel pipe, and we are prioritizing those projects based on risk. We request to manage this process by establishing the projects to be completed annually, which would enhance the safety of our system and gradually increase customer bills versus it all coming in one rate case.
Now, the other component of the SSIP is the proposed recovery mechanism. Could you just describe what the SSIP recovery mechanism is and how it will benefit customers?
Sure. Similar to other tracking mechanisms, our proposed projects would be submitted to the commission by March of each year, with rate recovery beginning in October of that year. Detailed cost information would be provided for each project, and as mentioned, no recovery would occur prior to commission approval. We would also have a true-up mechanism in March of the following year where we would true up any costs related to the prior year's project. You know, we believe it would be a very transparent process, providing opportunity for thorough review of each particular project. We do see some customer benefits here. I'm going to have Pat focus primarily on the safety, which we believe is the number one benefit to our customers. But the mechanism itself certainly provides benefits as well. And we've talked about the gradualism and then the reduced costs related to fewer rate cases. When you look at our proposed 2019 investment, what that would result in is a 42-cent per month increase related to this rider mechanism. So again, it's about a $6 million investment that would occur as part of our System Safety and Integrity Program, and that investment would result in a 42-cent per month increase if indeed this mechanism was implemented.
Ms. Cavista, one of the issues that has arisen with staff is concerns regarding the employee compensation system. As president and CEO of Montana Dakota Utilities, can you describe why incentive compensation or at-risk pay is important to the company?
Yeah, I think certainly as everyone in this room would recognize, attracting and retaining employees is one of my top priorities in my position. And we really do look at, and as supported by Jim Kaiser's testimony, a total rewards package, We're looking at studies that support our salary structure that reflects a combination of base pay, pay at risk, and benefits. And we look at all of that in total to make sure that we are competitive. We've employed this similar philosophy for the past 20 years, and we believe that if that whole is competitive, if the decision is that incentive pay is not allowed, to replace that with base pay would certainly only increase the cost to our customers, because a lot of our other benefits are predicated on base pay, such as a 401k contribution. So to move at-risk pay to base pay, we believe, would increase the cost for our customers.
Another issue that has arisen with staff is the use of the company airplane. Can you briefly explain why the use of the company airplane is important to Montana Dakota's gas operations?
Certainly. We do take the use of the company airplane seriously. I approve every request to use our corporate aircraft, and the reason we do that is because we want to make sure that it really is an economic decision. And so our use of that plane primarily would be for out-of-state trips. And for example, our customer call center is in Meridian, Idaho. That call center serves all of our customers across an 8-state territory. If we have a need to get employees to the call center and multiple employees are going to travel, we will compare the cost to fly them on the corporate airplane as compared to a commercial flight for those same five people, hotel stays, and whatnot. So we really look at the economics before using those that plane. Certainly, we also look at it for use in industry meetings and or training. In most cases, it's going to be more economical if more, you know, several people need to go to a location versus we're not using it for single travel trips.
Now, Montana Dakota is requesting a rate increase. Can you just explain how the requested rate increase will affect customers and their bills?
Sure. In terms of the overall increase, I mentioned the 3.3% in rate design. It was also covered in opening remarks, but really this slide just shows how that 3.3% would be allocated. As previously mentioned, the residential and general service would be seeing the increases, with the residential at 3.6% and our general service at 3.3%. When you look at the residential prices, in terms of the basic service charge, we are proposing that this increase goes to the basic service charge. Our current basic service charge is at $19.60, and this proposed increase would take that to $21.42. On the bottom half of the slide, you can see really how our customer bills break down. And currently, approximately 61% of that bill is still just the pass-through on the cost of gas. And so we believe, although with the basic service charge in place, a residential customer still does have and can see benefit by conservation of their use of natural gas. This represents, as previously mentioned, a $1.82 per month increase for our residential customers. And then just lastly, you know, when you look at that increase and where we're proposed, you can see on this graph that really our abundant supply of natural gas across the country and even locally here in the Bakken is certainly helping on our customer bills. When you compare back to 2008, you can see even with our proposal a pretty significant decrease in the overall cost for your average customer over the last 10 years.
And Ms. Cavisto, as President and CEO of Montana Dakota, are the rates the company requests in this proceeding just and reasonable?
Yes.
Would you like to make a closing statement?
Sure. I guess I would just like to echo the thanks to all the parties. We've heard that before, but it really does take an effort in working with all of our parties in putting these cases together. So I want to thank the commission, the advocacy staff, and all of our interveners for your interest in this case. Certainly my job is just similar to what the commission has stated, and that is really striking the balance between all of my interested parties, our customers, our employees, and the shareholders that provide us the capital to invest. And I look forward to the discussion over the next 3 days.
Your Honor, before I tender this witness, I'd like to offer Exhibit MDU-8. They're just a copy of the PowerPoint slides Ms. Cavisto has presented here today.
Any objection?
No objection.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Kaufman? Any objection to the PowerPoint?
No objection.
Okay. Major Unziker?
No objection, sir.
Okay. MDU Exhibit 8 will be received.
And, Your Honor, we'd also offer MDU Exhibit 11, 12, and 9 that Ms. Cavisto referenced in her presentation. These are the two NARUC resolutions and the AGA report she referenced.
Any objection?
We don't have any objection to the exhibits. Not sure where to reference them, but.
No, sir.
Mr. Kaufman.
no objection, assuming that, our competing resolution will be treated the same way.
Okay. Major?
No objection, sir.
Okay. All right, so give me those numbers again. So.
Those were MDU Exhibit 9, 11, and 12.
Okay, so MDU Exhibits 8, 9, 11, and 12 will be received without objection.
And with that, Your Honor, we tender Ms. Cavisto for cross.
Okay, questions for Ms. Cavisto. Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ms. Cavisto, in your direct testimony, you mentioned something about having four companies in eight states. What are those companies and what states do they operate in?
So we have Cascade Natural Gas that operates in Washington and Oregon, Intermountain Natural Gas operating in Idaho, Great Plains Natural Gas operating in North Dakota and Minnesota, and Montana Dakota operating in North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming.
And today you're here on behalf of Montana Dakota, correct?
That is correct.
And those other three companies would be your sister or brother companies all under the realm of MDU Resources, Inc.?
That is correct.
And you're the president or CEO and or CEO of all of those companies, correct?
That is correct.
And for all of those companies, you would be the person similar to this case, the one who authorizes filing of rate increases applications?
That's correct.
Am I correct that MDU is concerned with safety and reliability in all of those jurisdictions?
That is correct.
And does MDU provide gas distribution services in all of those jurisdictions? Do all of those companies provide gas distribution services?
Yes, they do.
Where they serve?
Yes.
And are all of those companies monopolistic, publicly regulated utilities where they provide those services?
That is correct.
And how long has Montana Dakota, specifically the Montana Dakota, that's all I'll talk about it, the company we're here today talking about, been providing gas distribution services?
For many years. Many decades.
And has it been able to provide a safe and reliable service to the people of North Dakota in that time?
Yes.
And regardless of what happens in this rate case, you intend to continue to do that, is that correct?
That is correct, although I would add that we have an aging infrastructure. So what we had decades ago, as I referenced when we were serving, was certainly newer pipe in the ground.
Are you aware of any of Montana Dakota's replacement or repair projects that have ever been denied recovery in a rate case in North Dakota?
I am not aware of any that have been denied.
Do you still have your slides in front of you?
Yep.
Could you turn to slide 5?
Yes.
I had a question for you just for clarification. When you were testifying, you testified that these slides were major investments. Are those major investments since the last rate case?
In this case, correct. Okay.
So the Newtown Border Station, that's been completed. Is that correct?
The Mandan one has, yes.
Okay. Well,
And so we have a forecasted test period, so not all investment has been completed at this point.
And which one of these have been completed?
Precisely which ones have? I mean, we've done distribution mains. We have border stations that have been completed. We have a looping system that's been completed, and I believe the interconnection is complete as well.
And mainly what I'm asking, are any of these major investments what you're talking about with the system safety and integrity plan program?
No, not specifically, no.
And you're not aware of anybody contesting recovery for those investments in this rate case, are you?
I am not.
Would you agree with me that by going through the rate case process for the many years Montana Dakota has been in business, that it has historically provided a safe and reliable system and been able to recover its costs?
Yes.
but now the company wants to implement the SSIP.
Correct, and again, I would echo the fact that we have an aging infrastructure. So at some point, we have to embark on a program to put a replacement strategy in place to minimize risk.
And do your other jurisdictions have aging infrastructure as well?
They do.
All your other jurisdictions have early vintage steel and plastic pipe as well, correct?
Different versions, and you know, each system is different. So you can't really compare each system to the next, but each system has aging infrastructure. I would agree with that.
And you said in your direct that 36 states have implemented some sort of recovery mechanism, such as you're requesting in this case.
That is correct.
Would it be fair to say that all of those other states have different levels of aging infrastructure as well?
In different types of pipe, yep, that would be correct.
Has Montana, Dakota requested SSIP in any of the other jurisdictions it operates in?
Yes, we have what I would call a safety tracker in the state of Washington, and we have it in the state of Minnesota. We we filed for it in Idaho, and we also are looking at file for it in our next Montana case, Wyoming case. We have already filed for it, or will file for it in Oregon. So we are looking at the mechanism and really across our 8-state territory.
So when you talk about it being in Washington, that's with Cascade, correct?
Correct.
And if you talk about it being in Idaho, that's with Intermountain, correct?
We filed for it in Idaho, correct.
What's the status? And that's through Intermountain, correct?
Correct. We do not know what this... It's pending.
And you filed for it in... Have you filed for it in South Dakota?
No, not at this time.
Have you filed for it in Montana?
Yes.
What's the status of that?
We just recently had a settlement in Montana.
How was SSIP affected by that?
Objection, Your Honor.
Sustained.
Your Honor, I think she's opened the door through the testimony leading up to it.
No, I disagree.
We've already said in your testimony that you're waiting for the next Montana rate case to file it again. Is that correct?
We will be filing in the next Montana case for an SSIP, yes.
You had a pending rate case in Montana up until recently, is that correct?
That is correct.
Has the Montana Commission recently ruled on your pending rate case in Montana?
Judge, I'm going to object to these pursuant to our previous discussion.
Sustained.
Ms. Judge, maybe at the conclusion of my other cross, we could take a break and discuss it as we talked yesterday.
Okay.
Ms. Cavisto, in your direct testimony, you indicate that the primary reason for the need for increased rates is an increased investment in distribution facilities to improve system safety and reliability and the depreciation in taxes associated with the increase in investment. Is that still the case?
Correct.
And you're talking about the SSIP there, correct?
Well, that would be all investment.
Okay. The SSIP, though, is not something that's being required of MDU by any law, is it?
Can you repeat the question?
You're not implementing the SSIP because some federal or state law is requiring you.
That is correct.
In fact, it's being done entirely voluntarily.
We have filed for the SSIP, I think, for the reasons I stated, and that is that we believe our system is only getting older, and at some point we need to take a proactive approach based on risk and assess what the right replacement strategy is to remove that aging infrastructure from our system so that we can continue to provide safe and reliable service.
And it's your testimony, the time for that is now through this rate case.
That is correct.
Even if the SSIP mechanism is not approved, MDU would still strive to provide a safe and reliable system, wouldn't it?
Yes, we would. But I would say that if we don't have that mechanism, it becomes a balancing act on how long it will take to get that replacement done. So as we've testified, this certainly helps us accelerate that replacement.
Because what it does is allow you to recover the cost of it on an annual basis.
That is correct.
So you'll provide a safe system anyway, you just need to recover the cost sooner. Is that essentially it?
I think it provides us some financial stability and also provides us the ability to do that over a time frame that is shorter than what it would take if indeed we don't have a recovery mechanism in place.
And that recovery mechanism would not have as much scrutiny as a rate case, would it?
The recovery mechanism, in my opinion, as we said, is each project will be completely, details will be provided. There will be the same level of scrutiny on a regular rate case. I don't see how that would be less scrutiny.
Will there be interveners?
I think the interveners have the right to intervene if they desire.
Will the commission staff be able to hire experts and counsel?
Legally, I would think so, but I guess I'm not maybe the one to answer that for sure. But
so are you envisioning a mini rate case every year then?
To me, whether how much involvement it takes to analyze the investment would certainly, in my mind, be less than it would take for a full-blown rate case. So I still believe that a three-day hearing for a full-blown rate case and the cost we'll incur for this hearing would certainly be more than even if you have interveners in your tracker. This case would certainly be more costly than a case predicated just on investment.
And you would agree with me that any replacement project should be reasonable and prudent, would you not?
Correct.
And you would agree with me that different subject matter experts often disagree on whether a project is reasonable and prudent?
That would probably be fair.
Moving on to a different area, Ms. Cavisto, who do you report to? Like, who do you answer to?
Dave Gooden, the president and CEO of MD Resources.
And are you paid under the total rewards philosophy as well?
I am.
And is part of your pay based on company earnings?
Yes.
And those are earnings that would go on to the shareholders, correct?
They are, but again, I think the shareholder, we need to recognize the importance of the shareholder because they are the ones that provide us the capital to invest in our system.
So are all employees part of the total reward system for Montana Dakota?
All employees are part of our total reward system at Montana Dakota, yes. I would say that our employees' goals are different than the general employees' goals are based on what I deem to be customer benefits. And so those goals are customer service and O&M targets, which in my mind go directly to the benefit of the customer.
So it sounds to me like there's at least two different levels of employees. Some under the total rewards philosophy are based on the O&M goals and customer service, correct?
All employees, we believe we put all employees under the total rewards philosophy. So all employees, including myself, have base pay, pay at risk, and benefits. And we look at total rewards as whether or not that full package is competitive relative to similar positions elsewhere. Sure. Goals are different. All of our employees' goals are based on customer service and O&M containment. My goals are based on earnings and ROIC.
And what is ROIC?
Return on invested capital.
And are any other employees' total rewards incentives based on returns or return on invested capital?
The only other ones are the executive team.
And how many people is that?
We have 9 executives in total at Montana Dakota. Not all are allocated to North Dakota.
You mentioned in your direct testimony that the interested parties in Montana Dakota are customers, employees, and shareholders.
Correct.
Would you agree with me that your shareholders also care about Montana Dakota providing good customer service?
I would agree they do care, yes.
Would you agree that your shareholders also care about reaching operations and maintenance goals?
Correct.
And are those, I've seen it referred to in different ways throughout the testimony. Some people say operation and maintenance goals, and some people say operation and maintenance expense goals. Do you know which one is more accurate?
It's really, the goal is to basically, that would be a target O&M expense, and to meet the goal, we have to end the year under that number.
And that would increase earnings as well, correct?
That would help earnings, yes.
Would you agree with me that your shareholders care about staying competitive in the industry?
I would agree.
Would you agree with me that your shareholders want the company to have a strong community focus and attract business?
I would agree, and I also agree our customers care about all 5 of those things you just asked me about.
I agree as well. Would you also agree with me that your shareholders want to provide safe and reliable service?
Correct.
As do customers?
Correct.
You talked a bit in your testimony about the use of the private aircraft.
Yes.
and you talked about reviewing it. Has MDU provided any documents comparing what commercial flights or anything would be compared to the use of the private aircraft?
As part of this case?
Yeah.
I am not aware that we have, but that may be a question for another witness.
Judge, subject to a discussion outside the room as discussed and potentially an offer of proof, I have no further questions.
All right. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco? Okay. Mr. Kaufman, questions for Ms. Cavista?
Yes, I have a few questions. Thank you. Good morning, Ms. Cavista.
Good morning.
Let me see. I'm just going to go through your testimony and see if you can help clarify some things for me. I'm looking at page 5 of your direct testimony, where you describe, about line 5, that the Montana-Dakota system has a low load factor with peak gas requirements occurring during the winter. Now, by low load factor, do you mean that there is great variation in usage over the year?
I think we're getting to the whole, winter peak. Yep.
So that's what I mean. And a high load factor would be less variable. Is that
correct?
Correct. So is it also true that you have, within the residential class, a good diversity among different customers, amongst how much different customers use?
I would say that usage does vary depending on, efficiency of the home, the size of the home, and all sorts of considerations. Correct.
And are you familiar with the handout that you provided at the public input meetings in this case? Handout?
Yes.
I don't think this is part of the exhibits here, but do you recall a slide that showed the low and typical and high use historical bill comparisons?
I do recall it. I certainly don't believe I could recite it, but I do recall the slide. I was at the public input meetings.
Well, if I refreshed your memory, would it sound correct that a low-use customer at 50 decatherms would have about $471 a year, where a typical-use customer at 91 decatherms would have about an annual cost of $636, and a high-use customer at 150 decatherms would be paying about $873?
Okay, that seems reasonable. The only caveat I would provide is I'm not sure if those numbers were based on our proposed increase before the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act or what those numbers were predicated on, but certainly we've had a change with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act.
Would it help if I showed you a copy of this handout? Or, Judge, would it?
Yes, you may.
May I approach the witness?
You may.
I believe it shows 2008, 2013, and then what are the last bars there?
Yep. So 2008, 2013, current and proposed. So I believe this proposed would not have reflected the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act.
So it would be somewhat less?
Correct.
Based on that. Okay.
Want to mark that and introduce it as an exhibit, or are you fine with the way you did it?
I could. Would there be any objection?
AARP 45.
45?
No objection. Is it just the one slide for the record?
Just the one slide, yeah.
All right. Sure. Okay, the whole thing.
Yeah. We would just want to clarify that that may not line up with what we're currently proposing.
Correct. Okay. Understood. But do you have any knowledge about the number of customers that you would find in a low use or high use category? What I'm trying to get to is the variability amongst usage within the residential class.
So I apologize, but I would not be able to tell you how many customers would be represented in high use versus low use, sir. I do not have that information in front of me.
Okay.
So before you go any further, Mr. Kaufman, let's mark that AARP 45, okay. And we'll call it handout of typical use for three levels of customers before the tax cuts.
Right. It'd be page 12 from the handout at the public input hearings.
Okay. And if you want to offer that, and it's been identified.
I would offer that as AARP 45.
Okay. Any objections, Mr. Sanderson?
No objection.
Mr. Armstrong?
No.
No. Jeff Kosaka. Major Unziker.
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Exhibit 45 will be received.
So the I believe you testified that the gas portion of the gas cost portion of the bill now is approximately 61% for a typical residential customer.
That is correct.
And we're only here today talking about the other 39%.
That's correct as well.
And so when you show the decrease in what a customer pays for their gas bill over time, that's almost completely related to the lower cost of the commodity, correct?
Correct.
And is it not true that the distribution cost has gone off, gone up over the last 10 years? Would you have a ballpark of what percentage the distribution portion of the bill has increased up until this rate case since 2008?
I do not have that percentage in front of me.
And would you agree with me that the fixed part of the bill has increased more than the volumetric part of the bill?
That is correct. As referenced in 2015, the commission had approved a fixed rate structure at that time.
And you'd agree with me that more detrimentally impacts low-usage customers than high-usage customers?
I would agree with that, but I would still contend that there is the ability to manage your bill through the conservation and your use of the energy product, which still represents 61% of the bill.
Yes, but you'd agree with me that, would you not, that a low-usage customer is someone who's paying less than the average is going to be, has seen a higher increase in percentage basis in their bills than the average or high-use customer over that time period?
Yeah, if I go back to the design of that, really,
is that a yes?
That's a yes, but what we need to keep in mind is our cost to serve a low-use customer and a high-use customer is the same. The amount of pipe we put in the ground, the amount of maintenance that takes place on that service line is the same, whether they're a low or high-use customer, and therefore the design of fixed versus variable.
Okay. I think in answer to staff questions, you did note that you were not aware of any issues that have ever been raised as far as the prudency of MDUs. Main replacements. Is that accurate?
That is accurate.
And so, no prudency issues have been raised in this case or in any other cases in your tenure, at least.
Well, in this case, I would caveat that we have the 2018 investment, and that discussion between us and advocacy staff, as Paul referenced in his open remarks, that investment was a difference between where we're at from a revenue ask and where advocacy staff was at.
And isn't that question less of a prudency question, more of a timing issue?
Well, they in their testimony, they kicked that investment out. So,
but the basis of that challenge was not prudence.
I guess I can't answer to that.
Okay.
For sure.
Do you believe that MDU has done a good job under your tenure of managing safety risk?
I believe we have done a good job. I would echo, though, that we do believe now is the time to implement a mechanism that will provide us the ability to look at proactively replacing our aging infrastructure. Our infrastructure is not getting any younger.
Is MDU's natural gas service currently safe and adequate?
I believe it is, yes.
Do you have any reason to believe that it would not be safe and adequate without the SSIP surcharge?
I believe to continue the safety of our system, we need to look at a safety program, and Pat will testify to that as well. We need to continue to look at ways to provide safety into the future. You cannot rest on your laurels just because you have a safe system today. Does not mean that if you don't proactively address the safety of your pipeline into the future, that you're going to continue to have a safe system.
Well, let me ask you about page 8, and the question is in the middle of the page there. You talk about you're proposing a structured replacement program, and you list early vintage steel, early vintage plastic, low-pressure systems, and the relocation of inside meters. And are these already, are these currently priorities for MDU's main replacement program?
These are
a different priority.
These are priorities today. In fact, the dollars included in the case that we are have differences in terms of, you know, those that Paul mentioned in his open remarks include projects in this category, correct?
So if you were granted an SSAP surcharge, this prioritization, your prioritization would not change, correct?
We will continue to focus on this type of pipe for the safety of our system. That is correct, whether we have the mechanism or not. As I described earlier, what the mechanism allows us to do is potentially look at this on a more accelerated basis. Excuse me.
Would the level of investment in main replacements that you are currently planning change? Would it increase the amount or just change the timing of the recovery of the cost for those replacements?
So if we are granted the mechanism, what we testified to is approximately what we would spend. We wouldn't increase the amount if we get the mechanism, if that's what you're asking. If we do not get the mechanism, what we will have to manage throughout our entire system, not just North Dakota, is how we adequately look at safety and reliability across our entire system and the recovery of such investment. And if, for example, we have too much regulatory lag or too much consideration, certainly we're going to have to make decisions, again, in the balancing act of our customers, our employees, and our shareholders, and there is a chance that we would take this replacement plan out over a longer period of time.
The AGA study, which was marked as Exhibit MDU-9, that study lists several different mechanisms from different states and provides some maps, but that particular study doesn't go into the details of those particular mechanisms and analyze them, does it?
The study does, but what was provided as part of the exhibit does not have all those details.
Does the broader study make any conclusions about whether those states have more safe or more adequate gas service than those states that don't?
I am not aware of any conclusions drawn such as that.
Isn't it true that in some states that have these accelerated surcharges, that there have been explosions and other safety incidents?
In some of the states that have the surcharges, yes, there have been natural gas explosions. In fact, I would say that is, in some cases, why there was response to implement a surcharge. And in some states where we have seen natural gas catastrophes and explosions, there have also been incentives, actually, for the company, or incentives have been provided to those companies to accelerate their action on safety improvement.
What I'm asking is if you are aware of any studies that have analyzed whether such mechanisms have actually increased safety and actually reduced explosions.
I think the implementation of these mechanisms are relatively new, so I have not seen a study that has said, certainly, if you've got incentive, financial incentive, to increase the safety of your system, I would think your system is more safe. So I would argue, but I have not seen a study that particularly calls that out that I'm aware of.
I mean, if your main contention is that this is going to help with safety, wouldn't it be good to have evidence that such mechanisms actually are linked to lower leakage rates or to less safety incidents?
I guess in my mind, the 36 states that have implemented these mechanisms so far have taken the position that it is the right thing to do to enhance the safety of the system. So if I'm going to provide either a financial incentive, a surcharge, or a mechanism such as the one we're referencing that allows the company to reduce regulatory lag, you are replacing old pipe with newer pipe, and by that very definition, you are enhancing the safety of your system.
So
I don't know that a study needs to be conducted to determine that.
I assume that you follow other Public Utility Commission cases around the country and follow trends. And
certain of those, yes, I do.
Would you agree with me that these mechanisms have been far from non-controversial, that there have been quite a bit of controversial disputes?
In certain states, I would agree with that. But in other states, I think there certainly was. I guess stepping back in terms of the safety of the natural gas system, in certain states where there has been incidents, I certainly feel that customers have embraced these types of programs. We are fortunate here in North Dakota that we have operated a very safe and reliable system, and I hope we can continue that into the future. But I certainly don't want to be one of those states that have to come in here after the fact and ask for a safety mechanism because I didn't ask for it before we had an accident or incident.
Well, would you agree that where there's been controversy, the controversy has been of a financial nature? The controversies have generally not been about the projects themselves and whether or not certain, you know, what the safety priorities have been. The issues have been whether or not the customer is being charged fairly, in whether it's a single issue mechanism or whether or not customers are getting the benefit of a full audit. Would that be fair?
I haven't seen a whole lot on the, in that regard. I mean, in the states where we have that, I haven't seen a whole lot of that.
Did you review the resolution from the NASUCA, the National Association of State Utility Consumer Advocates, that was marked as an AARP exhibit?
I did not specifically read that one, no.
But you do understand that...
I'm familiar with it, but I didn't read it in its entirety.
I assume you're familiar that consumer advocates in many states have raised concerns about single-issue rate making.
I am aware of that, yes.
And I ask you to hypothesize or speculate. If this mechanism, this SIP mechanism, been requested and granted in, say, 2015, would rates now be higher than they would have been, would be today?
If we would have gotten this mechanism in 2015, in general, I would say the answer to that would be no. We've been investing in the safety of our system since 2015. I'm not sure it would look much different. We would have just potentially had the ability to delay this rate case had we seen recovery on those investments sooner.
So customers would have been paying higher rates in 2016 and 2017 because they would have had a surcharge on their bill.
But by the time you get to today's implemented rates, it would have been approximately the same. It just would have been a more gradual increase as suggested in our testimony.
What can you say what percentage of this rate case's, what the company's revenue deficiency proposal is that would have been flowed through an SSIP mechanism had you had one granted in 2015? And how much would not have been part of that mechanism?
So as part of this case, I think we're looking at around $5 million of investment. And going back in time, I can't tell you the percentage, but I can tell you in 2017, as an example, that number would have been about a $2.8 million investment. In 2016, about $1.7 million. So I've got each year's total investment that we spent on safety and system safety and integrity, which would have correlated with this mechanism had we had it, but I don't know what percentage that represents of the overall increase.
Could you speculate whether or not this rate case would needed to have occurred if you'd had an SSAP mechanism granted in 2015?
I don't want to speculate on that. What I could tell you is there's a potential that we could have delayed that or pushed that out, but I don't want to speculate.
And you assert... I'm sorry.
I don't want to speculate with 100% certainty.
And you've asserted that this saves customers money because some rate cases may be delayed. Is that?
Or avoided.
And do you know what, could you estimate what the rate case expense is for this current case that would be included in rates?
I believe in this rate case we have represented that the approximate cost of this case is $350,000. They have averaged between $300,000 and $500,000. To do a full-blown rate case.
And would you agree with me that that's a pretty small amount compared against the TCGA savings that are being flowed through this case?
If you compare it to that, but again, if every dollar matters, as suggested by, you know, we do believe every dollar matters for our customer. So in this case, if we all believe that safety and reliability is in the best interest of all parties, certainly that's what these investments represent, and if we can avoid the costly rate cases, we believe that is the most prudent way to go.
Well, if this rate case were avoided, would residential ratepayers see the benefit of TCGA today?
Yes, they would. As referenced by Chairman, we each state essentially had called us in and asked for our response to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So most states are handling that as a single issue if you didn't have an open case.
On page 14 of your testimony, you reference your witness, Dr. Gaskey's analysis in support of a 10.0 return on equity. And I just like to ask you, do you believe that return on equity is a reflection of business risk?
Yes. That is one component, yes.
And do you believe that business risk and the allowed rate of return should be correlated? In other words, if your business is riskier, you should receive a higher ROE?
Correct.
Than otherwise. And would you agree with me that if the company is granted the benefit of an SSIP surcharge, your business risk will be less and your revenue would be more certain?
I don't necessarily agree with that philosophy because our return, our allowed return, is a return on rate base. And whether we've got an SSIP mechanism or not, rolling in that rate base, it's that return is what you're allowed to return on your total rate base. So the investment, whether it comes in through a general rate case or a safety system safety tracker, in my mind, doesn't really affect the overall return allowed on that ultimate investment in our system.
So do you believe if investors are looking at MDU, they will care one way or the other whether you have an SSIP mechanism?
I would say perhaps our credit analysts may provide benefit to our credit analysts and rating agencies that look at our debt and what kind of interest rate makes sense. They may care because it provides a little bit more stability for the company.
And it doesn't revenue stability equal less business risk for MDU?
Potentially, I guess. Maybe there's a minor impact there. But I still go back to your ROE is what you're allowed to earn on your investment. So whether that investment came in through a tracker mechanism or a general rate case, it's still a level of return on the investment in your system.
Would you agree with me if MDU's business risk is lessened, that the risk to customers is increased? I mean, is it a zero-sum game?
If MDU, say that one more time, so sorry.
If business risk changes, is there a corresponding shift of risk to ratepayers? Is it a zero-sum game, or can MDU's business risk be reduced without a corresponding shift of cost risk to consumers?
If our business risk changes, are you asking if that directly impacts our customers? It kind of depends on what component of business risk. There's all sorts of components, whether you're a small company, whether you operate in the Bakken, whether you don't. I mean, business risk is comprised of multiple things, so I can't really make a general statement on whether which specific business risk would have a direct impact on our customer.
But would you agree with me that risk to your business doesn't just go away, it's mitigated or it's shifted someplace if it's reduced? Would that be fair?
Right. If we have inherent business risk, you're right, it doesn't just go away. It's inherent. Yep.
Okay. I'll end there. That's all I have. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Major Unsicker, questions for Ms. Cavisto?
No questions, Your Honor.
Okay, at this point, Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, questions for Ms. Cavisto?
I did have a couple, and most of them were covered by Mr. Kaufman. But I wanted to follow up just a little bit because you had answered Mr. Armstrong about the financial stability benefit that was coming to the company if you're granted this SIP. And the questions that you also talked about, I think, in that question about how the replacements would then be over a shorter time frame. And I couldn't understand at that time, and I don't know that you got to it with Mr. Kaufman, that shorter time frame, can you explain that a little bit more to me? Because are you saying that your decision of whether or not to perform this upgrade or required maintenance would be different if you were under a SIP versus a standard rate case?
So
recovery
we
mechanism.
Are, in terms of looking at the safety of our system, we have done, I believe, a great job of prioritizing our risk. I think that's been demonstrated in testimony and rebuttal testimony that's been provided, so I won't belabor that. But we're going to look at the risk of our system and replace pipe that we believe needs to be replaced, whether we have this mechanism or not. I want to make that clear. What I think we would distinguish would be over how many years would we replace that infrastructure, and this is predicated on multiple things. In other words, our capital availability, you know, the timing and amount of crews that are available. But if we do not have a mechanism that provides for recovery over a more timelier period of time, we may make the decision to, instead of look at this over a 10-year period as an example, look at it over 15. But again, those decisions are not made in a vacuum. We consider it across our entire footprint and consider other states besides just the state of North Dakota. So those are things we'll take into consideration if we do not have the regulatory mechanism.
But if you have a safety issue or a risk, how can you possibly say that you'd make a business decision not to fix it as quickly as you could, based on how you would get recovery? I mean, you have an obligation to do the right thing, and you are guaranteed recovery for the right things you do under the regulatory system as it stands today. I have a real problem making that transition from the recovery mechanism to the business decision to maintain a safe and reliable system. How would you make a decision to go from 10 years to 15 years if it needed to be done?
If it needs to be done, we're going to do it. Again, I want to be clear on that. But when you're looking at replacing this kind of amount of pipe, as demonstrated here, there is some leeway within that replacement period. Whether you do that over, again, a 10-year period or a little bit longer period, there is some leeway in that period of time that you do it. We are going to make the investments that we need to make, as we have done for several decades, to maintain the safety of our system. We will do that. It's just a matter of studying what comes out of the studies that we're doing with respect to, for example, the early vintage plastic pipe. What we're doing there is going in and looking at different towns, pulling out samples of pipe. We're going to have, this is a process that will be fluid as we discover what we have buried in the ground and, what the studies predicate. And what I'm suggesting is, if we don't have that regulatory mechanism, perhaps we would adjust that slightly. I'm not talking about a major adjustment to the timetable here. And if there's an immediate need that's immediate this year, next year, we're going to do that.
So it sounds to me like you're saying, with the recovery mechanism, you may be replacing some things that there isn't immediate need for. And I think that's part of what advocacy staff was saying in the testimony, that there could be unreasonable replacements that haven't been justified. And if you don't get it, you possibly would be stretching it out and perhaps not be meeting your... I see this as sort of a vicious cycle. I'm not hearing any answers to close it off anywhere. But others can get to that question in a little more detail. I do want to go back then very quickly to this ROE, because we have hundreds of pages of testimony discussing, maybe not all of it, discussing the concept of risk and whether or not a more stable regulatory environment, which would include more stable financial recovery for this particular process, affects investor expectations and consequently ROE. I just heard you answer, Mr. Kaufman, that it did not. Again, I think you need to explain that a little further to me, because I'm not seeing that based on the rest of the testimony I'm reading.
Yeah, I think one factor within the, when you look at return on equity and what's being requested in the case, and I would defer some of this to our expert witness, Steve Gaskey, but as I look at the ROE that we're requesting, certainly business risk is a component of that. And but that of that component of business risk, it, you know, a smaller component of that would be, you know, financial risk. I mean, so there's multiple components that go into assessing what the right ROE is for a particular. You know, could you argue that you get a mechanism such as this? I mean, this is going to cover a small amount of our total capital. Certainly, it's not going to cover all the investment that we're putting into the ground. You know, he's arguing that maybe that would reduce the overall risk component. I'm not sure it's enough to affect our overall ROE. And what I'm saying is whether we get the investment put in the ground as part of a general rate case, or I guess recovery of the investment we put in the ground as part of a general rate case or as part of a tracker, really what you're looking at is what are you allowed to earn on the investment that you have in the ground.
Yeah, that part
that's what I'm saying, yeah. Okay.
Those are all the questions I have. Thank you.
Okay. We're going to take a break here. It's about 10:13. I'd like the attorneys and the witness and the court reporter back at 10:25 so we can go over an evidentiary issue, and then the commissioners, if you'd hold off a little longer till we resolve this evidentiary issue, hopefully we can have you back by about 10:30.
Okay.
For the commissioner's benefit, we had an evidentiary issue involving a document and whether a document should be admitted or not admitted. And I think we've resolved that issue, and there's going to be some additional questioning. First, we're going to go to the questioning by the commissioners, and then the attorneys are going to get one more go-around. So I'm not sure which commissioner wants to start. Commissioner Crocius.
All right. Good morning, Nicole.
Good morning.
Okay, so you're lucky in the sense that everyone else that has to testify is watching, thinking you'll be done, and they're not. I want to start with the SIP, the Safety System and Integrity Program, because that's really one of the more significant issues in the rate case for me. I'm really trying to get a handle on the risk factor, and just for an opening question, if you were a consumer or a household owner of a residence, would you be? Should they be concerned?
No.
So with that being said, and I assume that was the case, can you talk about the plastic pipe that you're talking about? Is that the biggest issue, or is it equal in terms of that and then the steel pipe?
Well, essentially what we've done is we've, in the testimony, and Pat can also reference this when he has the opportunity to testify, but we have presented basically a risk analysis around our aging infrastructure, and really what we're looking at is the likelihood of an event happening and the consequence, and what's factored into that risk analysis is all sorts of data points, such as the age of pipe, the type of pipe, leak, past leak survey, and Pat would be better to give all the details of that, but we've essentially compiled all that data to develop a risk score then for each of the various pieces of pipe in our system. And what that has done, the culmination of all of that data, has produced that what we believe to be our highest risk, which is the early vintage plastic pipe in the early vintage steel pipe. So depending on, you know, if you're asking which is the bigger piece, I'm not sure if you're asking by in terms of replacement dollars, you know, quantifying, would it be more to replace one or the other, or which is the risk? We really deem them, I don't have the exact scores in front of me, but since we've prioritized them both at the top, they've got to be very close in terms of risk.
Now, advocacy testimony asserts that the plan lacks detail. Would you agree with that?
I believe there is a lot of detail in our plan.
Now, one thing that was alluded to earlier, it's related to timing. The timing of why now, why not doing it as during the course of business as maintenance. There's always replacement. Would you agree?
Correct.
That you're looking at when you're running a company with a lot of infrastructure. So for me, the timing, that's the hardest part for me to get my arms around. Is the plastic pipe in question, is that good for another 5 years, another 10 years? How would you answer that?
And that's where I would talk to that we are bringing experts in to help us with that analysis. So on our plastic pipe, and again, Pat will be able to provide additional details here, but we are bringing in folks that are experts in the industry to help us analyze that. And we have been given some guidance from them in terms of even if you did nothing, how much longer would this pipe last in the ground? And so we're relying on our own internal experts, but we're also hiring folks to come in and help us with that analysis. In terms of the timing, and maybe just to clarify that, as I've mentioned before, but I want to echo again, if we have an urgent, immediate need from the safety perspective, we are going to replace it now, regardless of this mechanism. When I suggested about the timing and looking at how long do you replace this pipe over, how long will it last, to your questions, that's where we're relying on our internal experts as well as outside experts to help us with that analysis. Because what we do know is to go in and replace this all today and put it in the next rate case would certainly have massive consumer and customer impacts. And so again, back to my opening statement where we're trying to balance the interests of our employees, our customers, and our shareholders, that's what we're doing. We're looking at the risk. We're saying now is the time to start a replacement program where we want to work with the commission that you can help us identify and prioritize these projects based on what we believe are in the best interest of the company and over what time period makes sense.
In 1998, as a part of the testimony, and I honestly don't remember which sheet it was on or where I picked it up from, but there was a 1998 report about brittle pipe, mm-hmm. or pipe put in prior to 1988. So that report was issued 20 years ago. Would you frame it up as the SIP plan in some ways has been underway for a considerable period of time just through, you've been replacing pipe over the last 20 years, correct?
For years, yes.
So is it safe to assume that that report was certainly taken into account as a part of that replacement project, or?
Correct. Any industry guidance that's provided, as an example, on the L-Delay, which is a piece of our early vintage plastic pipe replacement program, that came out of a PHMSA report. So, you know, yes, we are monitoring industry action and what's taking place in our industry with respect to concerns that pop up, and then we identify whether we have them or don't have them in our system. Yes.
Have there been any leaks that you could tie to the old pipe?
We do have leaks throughout our system, yes.
But leaks that would be directly tied to aging infrastructure, not construction techniques, not something outside of, no, it's old pipe, the joints are failing, and I don't want to send a panic wave through because...
Right, we do have leaks in our system. Pat can probably better describe exactly where those are, but we do have some in conjunction with some of our older pipe. Again, not to alarm folks, we do leak survey annually in high consequence areas and that. But yes, leaks have been identified in certain segments of our pipe, including the pipe that we're replacing.
At a higher rate?
I'm going to defer that to Pat.
Okay. So the pipe stops at the meter. Is that
correct?
Fair statement. So from curb to meter or from main to...
That's our jurisdictional pipe,
right,
correct.
Right.
In-house is the customer.
Yep. So the problem pipe, if you will, or the high-risk infrastructure is outside of the home in most cases.
Right. Interior pipe is outside of our jurisdiction, so I can't comment on a customer's, the shape of any individual customer's interior pipe.
You have some inside meters?
We do have some inside meters.
So the pipe to the inside meter, though, in that instance?
Would be ours.
Right.
Yep.
Okay. Do you know offhand what percentage of, how many shutoff valves as a percent of home serve that you have in place, the excess flow valves?
Flow valves, yeah. I do not have that exact percentage. We may be able to get that for you. I do consider it at this point to be relatively low because essentially we have only installed that on new services. One of the advantages certainly of this replacement program would be the installation of excess flow valves on any new replacement that we do.
Right. That ties into a question that I'll check off. I'm going to jump over to... There was considerable testimony about the Tax Cut and Jobs Act and how that is impacting utilities across the country, not only from lowering rates, but also from a credit ratings standpoint for utilities. Has that negatively impacted MDU's ratings?
It has not. We have seen, certainly we, like other utilities, have seen the impact on cash flow. This change is affecting our cash flow, but we have not seen any credit rating changes because of that.
Now, Fitch and S&P have you rated at BBB+, correct?
Correct.
And how long have you been rated at BBB+?
I don't have the exact time frame, but for a lot of years.
So Moody's recently, and it was toward the end of January, changed the outlook of 25 U.S. regulated utilities, primarily impacted by tax reform. And I think for the majority, if not all, they went from they were downgraded.
Correct.
But just to verify, then, you were not included.
We were not included in that, no.
How do you, as I've read through a number of rate cases or rate adjustments across the country, the average gas utility across the country has lowered customer bills by $2 or more, typically in a range of $2 to $3. Your numbers came in differently when we adjusted the interim and I don't have that in front of me, but it was, let's see, from $2.44 it went down to $1.82. Was that driven by still leaving SIP into the equation, or how would you explain? That's a significant difference. And compared to what most utilities are granting their customers.
So I think I think what you're asking me is the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, how it impacted us as it compares to other utilities across the nation's impact.
Why wasn't as pronounced for the
Yeah, customers? I think really that comparison is going to be somewhat difficult because there were two impacts with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. One was taking the current rate from 35 to 21. And when you do that, you're really basing it on the revenue requirement. And it's probably hard to compare what kind of revenue requirement we need relative to another utility. The other piece of that change is going to be the repricing of your excess deferreds. And really both of those are predicated on the level of investment you have in the state that you're doing business. So if we've got a different level of investment than another utility, it's pretty hard to do a one-for-one comparison on the impacts of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. But I do know that we have other witnesses that are going to cover the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in a little more detail. But
okay. First quarter, you had a good first quarter. 45.7 million in terms of earnings in Q1.
Mm-hmm.
And that was for the regulated energy portion of your business, correct?
That would be for the utility, yes.
The utility. And that's up from 42.2 million last year. So an increase of 3.5 million. So when people see that, consumers see that, they're going to say, well, why are they asking for a rate increase when earnings are up? How would you answer that question?
I think what we need to consider, and when individuals are looking at either the MDU Resources news release or our portion of that news release, the thing that we need to keep in mind is when we're presenting a case in front of a commission, it is for that jurisdiction only. So today what we're here to talk about is North Dakota Gas. What you're looking at is a combination of our earnings across all of our states. So where we may be at our allowed return in another state, we may not be in this state. And so it really is hard to look at our overall earnings and compare that to a need in a particular jurisdiction, which is only a subset of our total utility.
Okay, fair enough. Do you have any concern with your credit worthiness as a result of tax reform? That was one of the factors or points that was made in a number of articles that I read. Any concern with that?
It certainly has impacted our cash flow, as I mentioned. At this point in conversations I've had with those that work with our rating agencies, we are not aware of any immediate concerns that they have, but certainly what they will do is monitor our financial metrics. And to the extent that they are deteriorating or that there's indication that because of the reduced cash flow, we're not going to be able to meet their, you know, they have standards that they want you to meet as a regulated utility. To the extent they see concern or deterioration of those over time, certainly that is something we are very mindful of. And that is one example on, you know, where we're concerned about our credit quality and our ability to raise debt and equity is the credit rating is very important to us. But at this point, we don't have any indication from those agencies other than we're going to continue to monitor your metrics.
Okay. I don't want to get into, you know, sensitive information on this question, but generally speaking, have you found it more challenging to deal with capital markets as a result of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act and the fact that you're a regulated utility?
I would say we have certainly seen the conversation change because it does impact regulated utilities different than it affects our unregulated businesses. So as an example, our corporate stock price, you know, there's conversation around the impact of the regulated utilities around tax reform. There's conversation with our credit rating agencies around tax reform. And in general, regulated utilities, the impact, although very beneficial for our customers, has a different impact for the business. And so, you know, there has been, you know, conversation around that.
On, and I believe it was in the Gaske testimony, and of course this is testimony ages, obviously, and at the time that it was written, cited uncertainty in oil pricing and slower customer growth outside of Bismarck and an increase in late payments. Does that still apply in terms of a slowdown now that oil prices have improved significantly?
Are you specifically asking about late payments or
no,
other impacts from
fact,
the Bakken?
We can take the late payment part and just set that aside.
Okay.
But customer growth and volume.
Yeah.
Is that still being impacted?
Our customer growth today is certainly different than it was years ago. And so if you're asking whether or not we're seeing, you know, substantial increases in the Bakken, we are not anymore. And so that growth has certainly slowed. I would say it's more stable today than it was as it was, you know, coming off of the highs of the Bakken boom.
Go to I want to just talk a little bit about households on limited income. What types of savings plans do you promote to a household that, and the reason I'm asking this is in some of the testimony, I think the rationale, or maybe not rationale, but it was stated that what a customer could do is they could decrease consumption, in effect. But I think if you're a customer that is already struggling financially, you really can't afford to then go out and buy new windows for the house. You may not even be able to afford to put new insulation in the attic. So they're certainly impacted because they're just in a tough financial position to do a lot about the house that they're probably fortunate to live in. What type of plans, educational initiatives do you present to those people? Because again, as I mentioned in my opening commentary, it's tough for some people. You know, every little bit matters. How do you work with them?
Yeah, I'd offer up, we have two considerations that are coming to mind here. We've got a balanced billing program where you can really look at levelizing your bill instead of, as mentioned previously, we're obviously generally on the gas side of the business, we're peaking in the winter. We have programs where you can balance that bill over the year. We also have low-income assistance programs available as well. And, you know, we will work with customers as needed. So.
Do you expect an uptick in low-income assistance need?
I don't know if I can predict that. I mean, based on this increase, I don't think I would predict a significant increase there. In terms of our bad debt, we have actually seen that come down over the last 3 years. A piece of that is probably attributed in North Dakota. I'm talking North Dakota only now, to the Bakken. And some of the more levelized, where that's levelized out there. But we have actually seen those write-offs come down.
Okay, would that be similar to just businesses that came for a short period of time?
It could be businesses.
Decided not to stay and left?
It could be businesses, could have been residential, correct.
Okay, but more stable, a stable business environment. I think I have more questions related to the timing of the infrastructure, but I think I will wait, or the infrastructure request, the SIP. I have still quite a number of questions on that, but I think I'll wait for the witness, the next witness, or not next one, but I will wait on that, and okay. I don't believe I have any other questions at this point. Thanks.
Commissioner Fedorchak. Questions?
Typically,
Okay.
Chairman,
thank you. Chairman
Christmas. I only have a few, so get ready.
I don't have my list.
Refresh me on who is the witness on the total rewards package.
Jim Kaiser.
Okay. Regarding the discussion between building, especially the residential rates, more toward volumetric or more toward a monthly base flat rate, do you have any statistics on how many meters you have out there that are, and I don't know what the right term would be, kind of occasional use things? I'm thinking where someone, you know, has gas hooked up so they can barbecue in the summer or something like that, or a garage that they only heat rarely over the winter, but for the most part have, even in the winter months, either just the base rate or very close to it.
I do not have that information in front of me. I apologize. I think we'd be able to get it for you, though.
I would be
limited use meters is what you're asking.
I would be very curious about that because if as we would go to a more volumetric system, if that were the case, those people would be the biggest beneficiaries. Am I correct?
Correct. Those that are using, you know, a limited amount of gas would benefit from more of that volumetric charge. And again, I guess where we're at with rate design is we really believe the cost, regardless of whether you use our service or not, we still had to put a service line in to get to your meter. We have to maintain that service line. And so our argument is similar to if you just were to compare it to a cable company. They don't charge you based on how long you watch your TV. They charge you to install the cable to your home. So we really are, the cost to serve each customer is really the same. So that's...
Things like cabins and such with a gas meter for barbecuing in the summer, that would not necessarily be...
They wouldn't be paying their share.
The fixed income type people.
Correct.
And do you have any statistics? I think your answer to one of the questions from Mr. Kaufman was that usage varies depending on size and efficiency of homes. Which is the bigger factor?
I would only be speculating. I'm not sure on that.
So you have no studies or anything that show that some of the typically newer but certainly larger homes with all the modern energy efficiencies, how much gas they use in relation to their smaller counterparts that might be older and not have those energy efficiency improvements?
Yeah, I'm guessing your more efficient, larger home is probably in better shape than your smaller, but that would be speculation. We probably do have data on that. I just don't have that at the top of my head.
It seems like in this discussion it would be useful data, and I just feel like it must be out there or else all the things we talk about all the time with promoting energy efficiency is all just a guessing game, and if that data isn't out there, we're just guessing whether it actually works or not. So if that could be provided, I'd sure be interested. I'm switching now to the SIP improvements. Are there historic pieces of equipment or types of pipe or anything like that within the gas industry that have just been banned that maybe were used years ago and found to be too dangerous and have all been replaced? And
well, certainly there, you know, cast iron and bare steel, have been a high priority essentially across the nation. We don't have that issue in North Dakota here, but completely 100% banned, I'm not aware, but there's certainly been studies that suggest, you know, whether certain type of pipe should be on a replacement program, such as bare steel, cast iron, you know, the PHMSA came out with the L-delay.
And explain why the cast iron and bare steel isn't an issue here.
Because we don't really have that in we don't have that type of pipe in the system.
Because
so we've got primarily plastic.
North Dakota was settled. Is that
we're correct?
Talking
about, I mean, I think
century
that's
century old year and
right. Okay. Yep.
So, how would you compare, safety agencies within the government's efforts to see that those types of pipe are replaced compared to what we're seeing? You mentioned the NARUC resolution. Mm-hmm. To promote the replacement in kind of a quick manner with the plastic pipe that we're talking about here.
Yeah, I think each state is really looking at it in terms of its own, I don't want to call them issues, but each state is evaluating what kind of system it has, what risk it has within its system, and, you know, they're making their decisions based on that. So similar to how we've evaluated what pipe we've got in the state, what type of risk we think it bears, and what priority we should put on in terms of the replacement, each state commission is going to be looking at, you know, what's being brought in front of them and evaluating what they deem to be at risk or not, along with, obviously, the utilities in that state.
But would it be fair to say that nationally, where that those other types of pipe exist, that there's been a stronger effort to see that those types of pipe are replaced than the type that you're talking about here? Or would you say they're comparable as far as safety risks?
I would say, you know, nationally, in terms of, you know, media and what you saw come out first was probably the bare steel and cast iron. Yep.
And you said that if the SIP program were adopted, that all the projects would not go forward without PSC approval, correct?
Correct.
The projects that are being worked on right now in New Salem and Fairview and the whole list mm-hmm. of towns, what approval process did they go through?
Right now they are part of this case. So they would...
You started construction on them without any advance approval.
Right, and that's because just like we do with other investments in a general rate case, we make investments that we believe are prudent and we bring them before the commission. In the case of a SSIP mechanism, we would file those projects with the commission in March, and then we would not get recovery on those prior to approval from the commission. That's really the way the mechanism works. Similar, we've got mechanisms on the electric side of the business in the state of North Dakota that are very similar to what we're suggesting here.
But when you file in March, is it going to be money that's pretty well already spent, though, because you've already bought supplies and hired contractors?
Potentially, not all of the dollars would be spent, but some of the dollars would be spent. But that goes back to, if I really feel it is a safety need, I have to proceed. And so we would be proceeding with some of the projects, you know, certainly in March. We won't have spent all of the dollars. In fact, it'd probably be very minimum considering the construction season in the state of North Dakota. But we would proceed with contractors and getting the work lined up if we believe it's the right thing to do from a safety perspective, yes.
No other questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Okay, thank you, Nicole. Yep. Just following up where Randy left off then on the timing. You'll file in March. You wouldn't get recovery until October. But you'd be starting on those projects that year?
Correct.
So if we deemed them to not be prudent, you just wouldn't get the money, or then what?
That would be correct, and we would probably bring them forward in the next general, or whatever rate base we're at in the next general rate case.
Okay. Is this tracker, can it be compared to riders for, say, on the electric side for transmission or generation? And in what way is it similar and how is it different, just in terms of how it would function?
It is very similar to what we have on the electric side of the business in terms of environmental and the generation and those types of tracking mechanisms.
Okay. Is the objection then that in those cases where we have the transmission, we have the generation, we have the environmental for all the electric utilities, maybe not the generation for all of them, but is the objection that in those cases we do an ADP, typically do an ADP or have pre-reviewed the projects before they get added to the rider on a separate way? And that mechanism isn't allowed here in the tracker you're proposing. Could that be a difference?
That would be a difference. I think you're right on our large projects, but we do not bring all of the dollars forward in the form of an ADP on the electric side of the business. So, you know, you're well aware, Thunder Spirit, we would have brought forward in an ADP, but not all transmission projects would have been brought forward in an ADP. So, certain of our projects on the electric side of the business that we deem to be large enough, we do bring those forward as part of the ADP, but not all dollars that go through the tracking mechanisms on the electric side of our business are brought forward in an ADP before they're put into those mechanisms.
Okay. So is there a Is there a way that the company could provide the big picture? Like, here's the whole plan. This is what we need to do. Here's what it's going to cost. Bring that forward through some sort of process like that, and then use a tracker to recover it. Is that feasible, or does it have to be this year-by-year kind of constantly changing, perhaps less thorough review of the systematic changes?
I think we would be open to bringing forward our plan over a time period. I think we, in general, provided that as part of the testimony here. We talked about the early vintage plastic pipe and what if we were to embark on that project, what the cost of that would be over the entire life of that project. We talked about the total project cost as it relates to the early vintage steel and early vintage plastic as part of the testimony here. But, you know, we would be open to, you know, more dialogue around looking at that plan in its entirety. I will say that as part of this plan, as I mentioned earlier, we are going through and working with other experts in the industry that we've hired to evaluate the pipe we're pulling out of the ground to make sure that we are making the right decisions in terms of what to prioritize first. Some of the data that comes out of those studies that are going to be done by GTI and others have the potential of changing the path and, you know, the outcome of what this, you know, long period or what the horizon looks like in terms of that replacement plan. But certainly as we know it today, you know, what we've presented in testimony is kind of where we're at with that plan.
Okay. I do have some more questions, like the percent of the system that's been identified at risk and the percent of the system that would be replaced and the percent that's vintage steel and plastic, but we don't want to take away everything
from Pat yeah.
to have to do his job. You've done a lot of his job already, so I think I'm going to save the rest of those specifics for him, but it is helpful to get your kind of view on this approach as a whole because it's a philosophy.
Yep.
so the help me to then my I think my final question on the specific mechanisms of this tracker as it relates to the mechanics of it. Help me understand the functionally how the tracker would be different than if you did this through rate cases. Would be looking at every year rate cases? Would you be looking at doing this in one big rate case after 5 years of investment? How would it functionally be different?
Yeah, I can't provide 100% certainty in terms of what this would mean in terms of would we be filing every year, every other year if we don't have the tracker. But what I do know is with the tracker, we would have less rate cases and than we would if we don't have it. To do the investment. So as an example, you said, you know, 5 years, would you wait 5 years and file for something? You know, at the level of investment we incur today and implementing this safety program, certainly waiting 5 years is not going to produce the financial results we need and, you know, to produce a strong financial company. And talking about the credit metrics and some of the earlier conversation with respect to tax reform, that lag would just probably be too much for us to absorb without some sort of detrimental impact on the financial side of our business. So certainly we wouldn't be able to wait 5 years without a mechanism. It's hard for me to predict exactly how many years that would be with a mechanism because it really depends on what level of other investment we have, how fast our customer growth, because, of course, that pays for some of this, is occurring in our communities in North Dakota. There's just a lot of variables there.
And how would you respond to the issues raised by staff and the ARP about the loss of the opportunity to look at offsetting issues in a tracker versus a rate case? How would the company address that and assure that you'd somehow would be able to take that into consideration?
certainly the biggest one that was referenced is the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and something that's significant, you know, that has that big of an impact, we are going to come in and address that individually. Smaller offsetting items, to the extent that those accumulate, you know, we'll be in for another general. It's not like implementing a tracker, which represents a pretty small portion of our overall investment, is going to eliminate the need entirely for rate cases. What we're saying is it reduces that and saves our consumer costs over time. But those all would be factored into an overall general case.
Okay. Okay, I have two other areas. One, just again, relating to the AARP's testimony about the 100% of the cost being allocated to the service charge, and there, can you really defend that? Is it 100% of it appropriately targeted to a basic service charge? Is it any portion related to the usage by the customers and from the company's standpoint?
So I would go back to, you know, really the rate design we've implemented, and we do have witnesses who will talk in more detail about the rate design as well, but goes back in terms of, again, the philosophical argument that we have, which is the cost to serve that customer is the same regardless of usage, and that's really how we've predicated our rate design in this case.
So you're saying it is 100% the same?
100%.
Like there's nothing that's related to usage. It's exactly the same regardless of how much they use, the cost to serve them.
Correct. Yes. Philosophically, the cost to serve the customer is the same regardless of how much gas they use.
Okay. All right. Then my final area here is relating to the ROE. How much are you involved in discussions with investors?
On a pretty regular basis.
Okay. And is it MDU Resources as a whole that is seeking the capital, or do you guys seek it separately? Do you have separate
so in terms
equity drives?
On the equity side of the business, we are funded through MDU Resources equity. On the debt side of the business, that is embedded at the utility specifically.
Okay. So how would you characterize the availability of capital for MDU now and the interest by investors in MDU and MDU utility?
So I would say the availability of capital, that, you know, the interest rates are, we're seeing an increase in interest rates on the debt side of the business. I think, you know, in terms of our ability to raise debt, I still feel, you know, very confident that we have the ability to raise the debt we need to fund the projects in our area. On the equity side of the business, in terms of our equity analysts, I was just recently at an AGA industry meeting where some of our investors come, and certainly they have the opportunity to pose questions of myself, of Dave Gooden, and, you know, a lot of their interest does, you know, come around when they're asking around the utility is the regulatory environments in which you operate. Are you at your allowed returns? And so there are a lot of questions around regulatory lag and how far behind are you with respect to your allowed returns? What are you earning in your states? And so there is a lot of interest in terms of our ability to earn at our allowed return. And all of that does factor into, of course, the MDU Resources stock price in total, which obviously influences our ability to raise equity in the capital markets to fund our projects.
So are you earning your authorized return today?
In the state of North Dakota, no.
What is it? What's your return?
I think in 2018, we projected our ROE with tax reform to be 6.128 without this increase.
And why? What would you say are the biggest factors preventing you from earning that return?
The investment that we've incurred since the last rate case.
So your rates are too low.
Correct.
Does that affect your ability to attract investors, that return that you're currently getting?
Correct. Yes, on an overall basis, I mean, our ability to not be at our allowed return certainly has an impact on MDU resources in total.
Can you speak to any specific issues that's created, as in higher interest rates or anything like that, that might affect customers? Like, what did the benefit? Why should customers care about this? Is there any benefit to them, to you guys, being appealing to Wall Street?
Yes, the benefit to our customers and why they should care about our shareholders and our debt holders is because they are the ones that give us the money to invest in our system so that we can provide safe and reliable service for our customers.
And is it, but you aren't having any trouble attracting that money, and so the difference between a 9.5 and 10% ROE matters a lot to customers because it's $500,000 less that they have to pay. How does it, why should we, and then therefore the customers, why should that perspective want to allow you a higher return? What benefit would it give them?
Basically, a more financially viable company through our ability to at least earn our authorized returns will add value over time to the company, thus increasing the stock price and reducing the amount of shares needed to be issued to raise the same amount of capital so that we can put investment in the ground.
But would you agree that a 9.5% return allowed ROE with rates that allow you to achieve that does that provides you what you need?
I mean, it's essentially whether we're talking about 10% or 9.5%, I'm going to defer that to Steve Gaske in terms of our ROE witness. But today, with rising interest rates, I believe that, you know, some of the allowed returns in our states have not contemplated the rising interest rate environment that has taken place over the last year.
Okay. And does this SSIP, how does Wall Street view those mechanisms?
Again, I would probably say that when you're looking at our debt analysts, they do take into consideration, you know, what I would call tracking, and they look at regulatory mechanisms that we have in place. So weather normalization, decoupling, fixed fee, some of those things. And the more stable you are, there is some value there. But again, I would come back to that is just one small component in setting the overall ROE for a utility, is the, you know, financial and or business risk of that company.
Okay. I think that's it. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, counsel, I would like to wrap up with this witness soon, but I'm going to give you one more go-around. Okay. Mr. Sanderson, any redirect?
Yeah, briefly, Your Honor. Ms. Cavisto, I want to go back and address some of the concerns about the timing and then the cost of the SSIP, because specifically with respect to the questions by AARP's counsel, and then more importantly by Commission's counsel, this fear of, are you telling us you're not going to, the cost is a factor and you're not going to replace this? Your testimony, as shown by the slides, was you currently have over 2,500 miles of pipe in North Dakota, correct?
Correct.
And you're just using the round math, you said 25% of it is over 50 years old, so roughly 650 miles. Could the company go out today and replace 650 miles of early vintage steel and plastic pipe?
Well, let's ask Pat Darris that. I think to answer your question, certainly that would be a challenge both operationally and, more importantly, the customer impact of such investment would be quite significant. So the first challenge would be operationally. We certainly could not handle that with our own crews. We would have to hire contractors. And then, more importantly, is the customer impact of doing that over a one-year time period would be very difficult.
And it gets to the point, and I think the point you were trying to make, Ms. Cavisto, budget and cost are factors that are weighed into this, the whole picture of what prioritizing projects and safety. Is that a fair representation of your statement?
That is correct.
But you, in addition to the recovery mechanism, the SSIP program that Mr. Darris is going to talk about in more detail, that's also trying to prioritize these projects based on risk analysis and other factors as well.
Is that is correct.
I want to give you a scenario, Ms. Cavisto, to maybe address two of these issues on the cost to serve and ROE and this issue with the strong company. Let's take the coldest night and Sunday night in January, and we have a gas line break. Is it important to have a strong company out there to serve customers and have the resources in place to provide quality and reliable service to North Dakota customers?
It certainly is.
And take that scenario. You have a gas line break. You've got to send out your technicians. Is there a difference in cost to the house that maybe only uses 70 decatherms versus the house that uses 110 decatherms?
No.
The repair costs that go out to fix that are
would be the same.
Okay. Ms. Cavisto, I have no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you, Ms. Cavisto. I just have a few questions for you. You're aware that yesterday Montana approved MDU's requested tariffs and did not include or approved MDU's tariffs and did not approve the requested SSIP tariff. Is that correct?
The SSIP tariff was not a part of the settlement.
And the SSIP is being deferred in Montana until the next general rate case.
We will be filing for an SSIP in our next general, yes.
And in North Dakota, the proposed SSIP, you said it will be filed in March, but you won't get recovery prior to approval, correct?
That is correct.
And once you get approval, though, there is a return component onto those projects, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So you will be earning a return on those before it's ever evaluated in a full rate case?
If the dollars are approved as part of the mechanism.
And that process to me does sound a lot similar to what an ADP is. Would you agree? An advance determination of prudence?
In an ADP, we are not earning on the investments once approved. We would get advance determination of prudence that it's a prudent project, but we're not going to get recovery on those projects until we roll that through either a tracker on the electric side of the business or do a general rate case.
But you're asking here for the projects to be approved and have a recovery on them then, so it's even more than an ADP.
Similar to our electric trackers in North Dakota, correct.
But in this case, there's not anything built into the mechanism for any additional review or similar to like we have in this rate case, is there?
There is an opportunity to review these projects.
Right. Is there a filing fee?
I don't know the answer to that.
So let me represent to you that I haven't seen any filing fee that allows commission to hire staff or experts. If that's the case, you would agree there's less scrutiny of that from commission staff.
I think the commission has the opportunity to look at the project similar to what's being done on the electric side of our business for those trackers.
And, for instance, the estimated 2019 SSIP amount is $6 million to be added to the rate base. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And that's something you would want to pass through that mechanism in that manner?
Correct. I think it's 42 cents per month if implemented.
It's not a small amount, is it?
42 cents
yeah.
per month? Six. I would call that somewhat minimal.
So if every dollar matters, at some point 42 cents doesn't matter.
Every dollar matters, but again, this is an investment in the safety and reliability of our system, and for 42 cents, I would say it would be a good investment in safety.
That's all the questions I have. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Kaufman.
Thank you. Ms. Cavisto, you were asked questions by Chairman Chrisman regarding house size and energy efficiency as it relates to the fixed portion of the bill, I believe, and I guess you said you didn't have data based on that, but isn't it true that the more volumetric your rates are, the more incentive there is for a customer to invest in energy efficiency or to engage in energy conservation?
And again, I would say that since 61% of the bill is based on the cost of gas, there still is incentive to conserve.
But that wasn't my question. My question is, if that was great, if the volumetric portion of your rates were greater, would that not provide a greater reward for energy efficiency?
It would, but for all the other reasons of serving that customer is the same, whether they use or don't use gas, we would still argue that the fixed rate is the right way to go.
So you just think that's enough? 61% is enough to provide an energy efficiency reward to customers?
I guess we're trying to look at the fairness across all of our customer classes and to consider that you have some households that have a meter with limited usage. It's just equally as unfair to those that are using a lot of gas when the cost to serve those customers is the same. So you've got to look at the entire customer base, not just one subset of our customers.
So your testimony here today is that it costs the same to deliver gas to every customer. It's the same.
Our fixed costs are essentially the same to install that service line, to a residential customer, as an example.
Are you familiar with the cost of service study that your company provided in this case?
Yes.
Could I refer you to Exhibit MDU-6? That's Mr. Hatzenbuehler's rebuttal testimony. If you have that with you. I just wanted to refer you to page one of his exhibits. So that's statement M, as in Montana, page one. The first page after his Q&A.
Okay, I think I'm there.
Okay, on that, and there, the cost of service is broken down for residential customers into the demand, energy, and customer components, correct?
Correct.
Do you see those columns? And the third column, which is the customer charge, that's the cost of the meter and billing and all the costs that are the same for every customer. Is that fair?
You're in which column? Can you say that one more time?
That would be the fourth column.
Okay.
The customer column. And that, and if you look down the column to the net distribution cost of service just before the double line, that's about $20 million. But the total residential cost is $26.9 million. Is that right?
Correct. That's what it looks like, yep.
So those other costs, the difference there are costs that are related either to the demand or energy components. And this is your own study, right?
Yes, it is.
And other witnesses in this case have taken issue with that and argued that the customer portion is even less. But this is your own witness says that the cost is not the same to serve every customer. Isn't that right?
I probably would defer this line of questioning to Jordan.
Right. Well, how important is the cost of service study, in your opinion, when setting rates within the residential class?
I think it's a component of getting to the right rate for our residential customers.
But if you put everything into a fixed fee for the delivery of cost, aren't you disregarding your own cost study?
Again, I'll probably defer these questions to Jordan.
Okay. I just have one more question, and it relates, to Commissioner Fedorchak's question about rate cases. And I guess you said that you might be able to delay rate cases perhaps longer than every 5 years if you had an SSIP in place. Is that what you said, or could you clarify that?
Yeah, I didn't say longer than 5 years. I don't want to predict that. To say that we could stay out for 5 years is, I want to be clear, that's okay. Not what I was intended to say, if that's how you're interpreting that. It is hard to predict when rate cases will be necessary, but what I do know is a mechanism such as this does allow us recovery that provides consideration for the fact that whether or not we could delay a potential general rate case.
So the benefit to customers in your argument is that say, $350,000 of rate case expense might be delayed down the future.
Right, 350 to 500 to whatever that number is, yes.
But under the SSIP paradigm, wouldn't you have two more rate cases every year or two cases of some sort, like limited issue cases?
As I mentioned earlier, we believe the costs of such a case would be substantially smaller than a fully blown litigated rate case.
Do you have a ballpark estimate of what those cases would cost?
I do not.
Okay. And isn't the real financial benefit to the utility a reduction of regulatory lag if you were to be granted an SSIP?
That would be the financial benefit to the utility and our creditors, correct.
Isn't another way to view regulatory lag from a customer's perspective is that it's the incentive to be cost efficient? Doesn't the regulatory lag provide some incentive for the utility to be more cost efficient in the short term?
As part of a general rate case, all of our, as you have seen by the differences of opinion between us and our interveners, you have seen that expenses are fully scrubbed as part of a general rate case. So I believe our incentive to operate efficiently is certainly not reduced by changing the way that we would implement a mechanism such as this.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your perspective on that. But under the SSIP mechanism, ratepayers would have more frequent rate increases, correct?
That would be correct.
But they would be smaller.
That's correct.
And there would be pre-approval of projects that are not currently pre-approved. Is that right?
I don't necessarily agree with pre-approval. We are going to proceed with the projects that we deem necessary, just like we do today. And it's not that we'll get pre-approval necessarily, other than if we get a decision before we actually execute that specific project. But that would be probably more by happenstance, because we're going to continue to proceed with these safety projects. So I don't know that I would necessarily call it pre-approval.
But does it provide some regulatory certainty that you wouldn't have under the current system?
To some degree, potentially.
That's all I have. Thank you very much.
Major, I was beginning to think you might be a colonel before we get finished with this work.
I do just have one follow-up question. It's the follow-up to Commissioner Fedorchuk's questions on ROE. Ma'am, you'd said you're generally familiar with other rate cases that go on throughout the country?
Correct.
Are you familiar with the ROEs in those cases?
I believe Dr. Gaske has testimony with respect to ROE achieved in other cases across the country, yes.
Okay.
I don't know if I've got all the specifics in front of me. Perhaps I do.
Well, in general, over the past 10 years, would you agree that those ROEs for both electric and gas have traditionally been going down on average?
I would agree, because the interest rate environment was decreasing over the last 10 years, and now we're heading into an increasing interest rate environment.
Great. That's all I had. Thank you, ma'am.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
I have no questions.
Okay, Ms. Cavisto, you can step down.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Sanderson.
Yes, this time Montana Dakota would call Pat Darris.
Let's go for a while. Mr. Garris, I'll have you spell your last name for the record.
D-A-R-R-A-S.
And I'll have you raise your right hand. You were here when I gave the perjury admonition. You promised to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
Yes.
Okay. You may sit down. Mr. Sanderson.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Darris. Can you please state your full name and business address for the record?
Patrick Darris, 400 North 4th Street.
And whom are you employed by?
Montana Dakota Utilities.
And what is your position with Montana Dakota Utilities?
I am the Vice President of Operations and Engineering.
And could you just briefly describe your responsibilities in that role?
Yes, I have executive oversight for both the gas and electric operations.
And Mr. Darris, could you just provide a brief overview of your educational background and work experience?
Yes, I'm a graduate of North Dakota State University with a Bachelor of Science in Construction Engineering. I've also got a Master's in Management and a Master's of Business Administration from the University of Mary. Been with the company approximately 16 years, all in the operations side of the business. Started as an engineer, field engineer, and then was moved up into a region superintendent position, overseeing just the gas side. Then from there, in 2008, was moved into the position of region director, where I oversaw the gas and electric operations for the Dakota Heartland region. And in 2015, was moved into the position that I currently hold today.
And Mr. Darris, are you familiar with MDU's application for a natural gas rate increase in this case?
Yes, I am.
And what was your role in, a general role in, with respect to this case?
General role would have been really testifying, I guess, in, as far as the SSIP program itself.
And Mr. Darris, did you submit both pre-filed direct and rebuttal testimony in this proceeding?
Yes, I did.
And if asked the same questions as indicated in your pre-filed testimonies, would your answers remain the same?
Yes.
In addition, have you prepared some PowerPoint slides regarding your areas of testimony today?
Yes, I have.
And as we go through your questions, if you want to refer to your PowerPoint slides, please do so. But generally, Mr. Darris, can you just describe the challenges in operating a safe and reliable gas system in North Dakota?
Sure. Can I? Is this? Let me just get to the right slides. There we go.
Is that an exhibit, Paul?
I'll offer it at the end again.
Okay.
And certainly, Judge, it's MDU exhibit number 10. It's in the exhibit book that the commission has, and we provided to all the attorneys. So if you, instead of turning around, you want to look in your exhibit book.
Thanks.
Thank you. So, Mr. Darris, just briefly describe the challenges in operating a safe and reliable gas system.
Sure. When we look at the challenges, obviously, there's a lot of different types of challenges, but the ones that we've talked about the most, I guess, and or will be talking about, really is the aging infrastructure that we see at Montana Dakota. It's also across the industry-wide. It's not something unique to Montana Dakota, but we will get into the details of that as far as we're concerned. Changing regulations, again, that is an industry-wide item. And then unknown attributes, and what I say, I've got pre-code versus post-code on there. When I mention pre-code, I'm referencing the PHMSA 192 part that we have to follow, the safety guidelines. And basically, post-code would be post when that was implemented, which was in 1970. Prior to that, obviously, there was different regulations, requirements of operators. So when we say pre-code and unknown attributes, that would be that we truly do not know what is in the ground. We were not required to, and to this day we still do not understand what's in the ground.
And Mr. Darris, is that just a problem facing in Montana Dakota, or is that an industry-wide across the country?
That is industry-wide. Again, I think each operators unique in how much of the unknown is out there, but again, it is something that is required of us to report every year to the federal, to PHMSA, basically. In our 7100 report, we have to put how many miles of pipe that are unknown or have unknown attributes. So, and that is a requirement of all utilities across the United States. And then the last one I do mention is the increasing costs, and again, that's construction costs, material costs, really everything related to the operation of the system.
And Mr. Darris, your next slide indicates a typical early vintage steel mechanical fitting. Can you just describe what we're looking at in that picture and why you included that?
Yeah, I think throughout my testimony you'll hear me talk about dresser couplings or mechanical fittings. What you see there, if you look at the pipe, it looks pretty good where it's been cleaned off on the lower left-hand side. That is installed in 1937. We just dug that up last year due to a forced main replacement project. But when we talk about the potential for leaks, and again, this was not leaking pipe. What I like to point out is the dresser couplings themselves, which are the square items there. You can see really at both tees, the ones in the shadow, but there is five dresser couplings on that picture alone. You got a line going up to the, let's say the top right, and a line going to the top left, and then the line to the bottom right and left. And each one of those connections is was put together back in the 30s, we will say, or late 30s, with those dresser couplings. So they have been in the system for close to 100 years, let's say 80 years. The way those fittings work, they've got a rubber gasket that basically compresses down on two pieces of pipe. So again, there is the risk, the potential risk that we see when we're talking about dresser couplings themselves and this older vintage pipe. In this case, this pipe was not leaking. It has been in the system for many years. Is there a risk there? Yes, there is. So,
Mr. Darris, now I want to turn and focus initially on the various projects included in the Montana-Dakota's 2018 main and service line replacement that are included in this case. Can you just describe to the commissioners those projects and what's happening?
Sure, and when we talk about these, again, these are not a part of the SSIP program that we're saying. These are the 18 projects that are in the rate case itself. So basically the towns that we have identified as projects that will go on this year in 2018 are Taylor, Fairview, Gladstone, New Salem, Eldridge, Barlow, and Cleveland. And there's really a mix, as you can see, after the names of each of those towns on what type of pipe or what type of materials in those systems that we'll be replacing. To date, I believe we have signed contracts for all seven of them. To date, we've got crews on the ground in Barlow, Taylor, and New Salem.
And are some of those contractors doing multiple towns for Montana-Dakota?
Yes, they are. For those projects, actually, the three different towns that they're working are three different contractors, and they will be doing multiple towns.
And as Mr. Darris, as part of this project in these towns, is the company testing pipe, or can you describe what's being done as you do these projects?
Sure, and I've got a later slide that I can get into a little bit more of the early vintage plastic pipe study. We will be taking samples out of these towns and sending those in to a third-party contractor. And again, this is the piece of this, the whole SSIP, which I refer to as the program itself, is fluid. When I look at it from an operational standpoint, it's truly fluid. We are changing this thing on a daily basis based on what information we get in from the field, from different regulation changes, from different studies that are out there beyond what we do internally. So as part of the plastic pipe that we have slated for this year, the intent is to really take different vintages. And when I say that, we talk pre-1983, which I'll mention in a different slide too, but really it's to take that pre-1983, which has been identified as industry by a higher risk factor, and we're trying to take the lower and the upper limits of that. So one of our towns we'll be studying is in the 1971 vintage for the most of the pipe. One of the other towns is in that higher limit, which is 1981 pipe. And then the third town that we'll be doing is the unknown, which a majority of the pipe in that system that we show on our GIS is unknown.
Okay. Now, I want to get into, Mr. Darris, the SSIP program. Can you please explain why the company Montana-Dakota needs and developed and implemented the SSIP program?
Sure. I think up on the screen I've got the drivers, or I call them drivers. I would say that one of the, if you look at it from an industry-wide basis, it's probably those top four bullets, which would be the recent fatal accidents that we talk about or that are known as far as in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and San Bruno, California. The other piece is the PHMSA Integrity Management Program, or the IAM program, that was rolled out and signed into law in 2011. Again, I say aging infrastructure on the slide there, but that's really from an industry-wide basis. This is not something unique to Montana, Dakota. And then really just recently, I would say there has been a large push by federal, through federal guidelines, really to look at systems on a more proactive versus reactive approach. And again, this is industry-wide. The one thing I want to point out there that's out there is an API recommended practice. Again, it is recommended. It is not to date a code requirement by PHMSA. They have had many meetings on that to see if they should move that direction. But right now, they are trusting industry to take the seriousness of pipeline safety and really look at it from a proactive approach versus the reactive that has been more commonly done in the past. So that's really the industry-wide side. From MDU's standpoint, we are really looking at it, or what's driving it for us is to better understand our threats. Like I said, we have a large percentage of our pipe or our system that is unknown to us. That's why we're doing studies like the plastic pipe study. It's the going back to the picture that I had on the slide, those dresser couplings do not show up anywhere on our maps. We have to dig it up, and when we dig it up, we get an email from the field basically saying, look at what we found here. There's 5 dresser couplings on there. We didn't know that. We show that it goes 4 different directions. What we don't know is how many dresser couplings are there. The other thing that we've done is just this more defined systematic approach to identified replacement projects. Again, I look at this as a more formalized approach to how we're going to replace our pipe going forward. Again, we have replaced pipe for years. It's something we will continue to do based on risks, but this is for us to really take it and try and formalize the approach versus a more, I'm going to say, reactive way of handling the way we replace pipe in the past. And then the last piece I would just throw in there is really the funding mechanism to avoid frequent rate cases. Again, that is there's 2 different ways that I look at this. Obviously, from an operations standpoint, I am looking at it from a truly system safety standpoint. But as Nicole's testified, there is the funding mechanism that, as she has talked about, how that would help us, I guess, fund some of these projects.
And your focus of your testimony is on the application of the program and mechanical side of this.
Correct, the operations.
Yeah, and Mr. Darris, just for the record, attached to MDU Exhibit 3, your rebuttal testimony, marked as Exhibit PCD2, is a copy of the SSIP program as revised as of March 15th of this year, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Now, Mr. Darris, can you explain, you've talked about PHMSA, but can you explain the PHMSA Integrity Management Program and how it relates to what the company's doing?
Sure. So the PHMSA IAM program, again, it falls under Part 192, which are the minimum requirements that are required of all operators to operate a gas system. Basically, that was rolled out in or signed into law in 2011. What I would say is that really it followed along the same path as the transmission side of integrity management, which was signed into law in 2006. Again, integrity management is growing. As you can see, that's, you know, it's 10 years and it's gone from transmission, and 5 years later it went into distribution. So really when I'm talking this program, we are focused for this program just on the distribution side of things, which is what's called the IM versus the TIMP or TIMP program. Really the objective of what PHMSA requires us to do is to really develop a model, which we call internally a DIMP model, and to better understand our system and identify those threats. again, once we've identified the threats, now we have to put a risk profile to that and truly determine internally how we want to go about mitigating that risk or that threat. When you look at it, one thing that is a requirement that all operators have to follow is the eight threat categories that I've got up there, which are corrosion, natural forces, equipment failure, excavation, incorrect operation, joint failure, outside force, and other. So each one of those has a risk score associated with it, and then also the pipe that's associated with that to come up with a risk ratio, basically.
And Mr. Darris, using your next couple slides, can you just explain the company's SSIP program and how you intend to implement it and manage it?
Sure. So from a high level, the Structured Replacement Plan or the SSIP program is really what we've focused on is we being internally with our SMEs is truly the what we're calling the early vintage steel pipe. We have drawn the line at pre-1970 or, as I mentioned earlier, pre-code. And then the early vintage plastic pipe, which I'll talk about, basically it's a pre-1983. And again, this comes from some of the documents that were talked about during Nicole's testimony, and then post-1982. And then also, as part of the program, we would look to replace basically all associated fittings with that, and then also the inside meter sets that are tied to it. In a little more detail on the early vintage steel pipe, what we're looking at is the higher risk pipe is identified by a couple of different factors. Number one factor is our DIMP model. And again, what you need to realize is this DIMP model changes on a regular basis. We are required by PHMSA to review that our program annually, but the DIMP model can change based on information we get from the field. We have the ability and the expectation to go into that model as we learn of new information that could affect the risk scores. And then really the other big piece to this is the subject matter expert input, and that's our folks in the field that truly understand what they're digging up. As I mentioned with the picture, they know what's in the ground. We bring those type of people in when we adjust the model, and really what they do is they look at the data that the model itself puts out based on the risk that we assign to different threats, and they tell us whether they truly feel that the model's given an accurate picture of our system, and then we adjust that model from there. And then if you look at the early vintage plastic pipe, again, I had mentioned the study that we've got in place. Really what we've done is through this, I testified, or there's documents I know through data requests that showed that in order to replace all plastic pipe that's that pre-1982 vintage, we quoted $148 million. And again, what we're trying to do, we realize from an operational standpoint, like Nicole testified, that would be a huge task if we were to do it over a year or two. What we're trying to figure out is what is that true risk based on what we see, plus what other groups are seeing. There has been a lot of data research done, a lot of testing done on this through GTI and others, through AGA. AGA's got a white paper. And again, they're all recommendations. There's nothing required in any of those. They give you more data to basically try and analyze your own system. So that's what we're hoping to do with our study. We also will be able to determine the presence of the low ductile inner wall characteristic. That is the potential for a certain resin that was built or that was used to make this pipe in the early 70s, 71 and 72, that shows a potential for a characteristic of brittle-like cracking. Basically, over time, there will be a crack in that pipe. We have not had that in our system to date, saying that. there's nothing saying that it can't, and that's what we're trying to determine through this study, is if we truly have this low ductile inner wall characteristic with some of the pipe that we'll be digging up. The other thing that we've been told we should be able to get from this study is to determine the remaining life expectancy of this pipe. Again, this was installed, I'm going to say, from that 71 to 83 time frame for most of our system. So it's been there a long time already. What we're hoping to get out of it is based on their expertise telling us how many years are left with that. And then also, obviously, the results of this study, then we take that and move it into our model, and we will change and adjust our DIMP model itself accordingly. So when you look at the study itself and the projects, we picked, I mentioned this earlier, so I'll go through it quick, but basically Eldridge is the town that's mainly 1971 pipe. Barlow's the town that we're doing that's mainly 1981 pipe, and then Cleveland has the mainly unknown vintage. Again, we're working with industry groups for their R&D, the AGA, and then GTI.
And Mr. Darris, can you just describe the company's plans going beyond, in the future, beyond 2018? With respect to its SSIP program?
With respect to the plan as it stands, what was submitted, and again, this is fluid, is 2019, as it stands today, we would plan to work on Glen Ullin, which includes both steel pipe and the plastic L delay pipe, the Mandan low pressure system, and the Dickinson low pressure system. And then moving on to 2020 through 2022, we would continue with both the Mandan low pressure and the Dickinson low pressure system.
And Mr. Darris, can you explain why early vintage steel pipe low pressure systems pose a safety risk?
Yeah, I will. I guess as far as looking at low pressure itself, you need to look at it as a system as a whole. The pipe itself, if we dig it up like I showed in that picture, the pipe itself is probably going to be in good shape. It's the fittings that tie it together. It's the location of it. Generally, what you will see in MDU system anyway is this is our oldest vintage pipe in the oldest areas of town, which are downtown, which is a high consequence area. So, again, these are all factors when we're looking at how we prioritize projects. That's why we internally have focused on low pressure and said it's a higher risk. There's other things that, from an operational standpoint, if you do have that leak that you had mentioned in January, this is an ounce system. If you have a pound system that's leaking, the public may or may not, but the public may be able to hear that leak, smell that leak easier underneath this ground. Low pressure, it is a slow leak that's going to migrate and eventually find some place to come out of that ground. It may be through a crack in the snow or the ice. It may be through a crack in a foundation. And again, when we say where these are located, low pressure is located mainly in downtown areas of cities. So that's really the operational threat or the risk that is out there. The other piece that I just want to mention is the potential for cathodic issues, and when I say that, that's the corrosion issues on low pressure. Again, these are put together with dresser couplings, as you saw in that picture. What that does is isolate two pieces of pipe from each other. There is another potential failure that could happen with the corrosion side of things, because you've got an isolated piece of pipe. We protect it either through anodes or direct current, our systems, to basically save that pipe from corroding. So there are systems in place to protect the pipe. What you don't necessarily catch immediately is if there is a short, which can be caused from some of these dresser couplings. And then the last thing I would say is, generally, low pressure is larger pipe. It's large diameter pipe. Again, it's located in downtown areas for the most part. It's very cumbersome to work around. If you do have issues, you're tearing up a lot more space. A lot of it is in back alleys. or streets. Obviously, it's not in your boulevards like you see a lot of your plastic pipe or more current pipe today.
And Mr. Darris, industry-wide, is there a lot of low-pressure systems in the country?
There is not. Again, it's unique. I would like to mention, I mean, a lot of the projects that are out there, we talk cast iron and we talk bare steel. We've got bare steel. I will correct Nicole on that. We've got protected bare steel, which means that we are protecting it from corrosion. There is a difference when you put it on the 7100 report. So basically, all of ours, to our knowledge, is protected from corrosion. There is some bare that we try to get rid of throughout the years. So ultimately, I mean, it's. We feel there's that threat there, and that's what we are trying to eliminate through the program.
And Mr. Darris, from the operational side of Montana Dakota's SSIP program, can you explain the benefits to customers of this program?
From the operational side, it's safety. Safety is truly the number one thing that I want to point out. It's an improvement. Again, is there a guarantee that we will never have an incident? No, there's not. As Mr. Armstrong mentioned earlier, MDU, as far as he knows, has operated a safe and reliable system in the past or forever. That's something we're very proud of. What I want to point out is just because we've operated a safe system in the past, our past success does not guarantee anything in the future. So we are doing, we're implementing programs, something like this, to try and help us guarantee ourselves that we do not have that one incident.
And finally, Mr. Darris, advocacy staff's expert cites a January 2017 U.S. Department of Energy report entitled Natural Gas Infrastructure Modernization Programs at Local Distribution Companies, Key Issues and Considerations. Do you feel this report supports the company's SSIP proposal in this case?
I do feel it supports it. When you look at that, again, there's many different programs that are out there across the United States. Again, I would say some of them are within the very recent past is when they've been implemented. Again, when I look through that, you can go through there and you can see that there may be a company or two that's looked at low pressure. There may be a company or two that's getting recovery through LDLA. Again, the majority of them are cast iron. I will say that. We are fortunate that we don't have cast iron. We do have bare pipe. So to me, it supports it because we're not unique. We aren't on that list, or this isn't the first utility that's tried to come for some type of a recovery mechanism for low pressure like we're focusing on, or early vintage steel. The other thing it points out is I don't believe, in my opinion, it does not clarify what early vintage truly is. There's no definition for that. We are clarifying it that we are calling it pre-1970 or pre-code. But early vintage pipe, it could be assumed that it's cast iron, or it could be assumed that it's bare steel. But does that mean that if you don't have cast iron or bare steel in your system is risk-free, or that you don't have early vintage? The one thing I picked up on is it says that there's systems out there that are 100 years old. I showed you a picture of a system that we dug up last year that's 80 years old. So I think that's why it supports it, is because there's really no guideline in that, from my opinion, that tells you that it can only be for cast iron or only be for bare steel.
Thank you, Mr. Darris. Your Honor, we would offer MDU Exhibit 10, the PowerPoint slides of Mr. Darris.
Any objection?
No objection.
No.
Mr. Kaufman?
No objection.
Major?
No objection.
Okay. All right, that Exhibit 10 will be received. And should we take a break for lunch here? Does that work for you? Or?
That would be my preference.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Can we be back in 45 minutes or so? Everybody back by 1 at the latest? Okay.
Yes.
All right. Okay, we'll be back at 1.